for the two styles. To adapt to the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, predatory, and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fight from his lips. Burn the slave driver.
To Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people will turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. Thought of like getting get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream at that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. We're streaming at abitumi.com/timeforanawakening. That's abitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream from Ghana. Or catch the live stream by downloading the TuneIn Radio app. TuneIn Radio app is a free app, and it can go on any of your devices. In that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So, again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:07 here in the city of Philadelphia on this cold Sunday evening, and we're in the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. The Sunday, January 15th, 2023 edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening, scheduled to join us, and hopefully he can because there's a lot of serious weather going on in California, is author, professor of political and African-American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor, is scheduled to join us in discussion this evening. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, 7:12 in this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Well, I've been a little under the weather again. I don't know what's going on, but I am getting past it. But I am excited, and I appreciate Professor Taylor for indulging our conversation around tonight, you know, as we, you know, we tried to get to talk about politics from a historical perspective, not just politics, but the party politics and the political philosophy. And I think that we're investigating it, I think would be safe to say. The Negro Womp, what did that mean in that period? How did that affect us in relationship to the electoral politics of that time? And is there any relevance to that position to now? I was just looking at that article again where it said the four largest cities in America are run by black mayors, but they're all a part of the Democratic Party. Should we be taking lessons from that? So I'm glad that Dr. Taylor is with us to help us explore that period and what lessons we have that we should look at the party system and our place in it from a material resource perspective today.
You know, Richard, this, I think this should be an interesting conversation because what was going on during the turn of the 20th century early on, you had a lot of people that made great impact in our communities at that time. You had Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, the elder that we're going to be speaking about this evening, William Monroe Trotter, Marcus Garvey came on a little later. But you had a lot of things going on. And in the backdrop of all of that, Richard, you had our people struggling for the rights that was supposed to have been given in those amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. They were still struggling in the early part of the century. And the debates were going on between our people politically about what we should do, how we should move forward. Those discussions were being had. But other things were going on also, and we're going to try to touch on all of those things tonight. But, you know, it's a similar situation to what we're dealing with, Richard. The only thing different back then is you had a lot of wanton murders of black people and cities being attacked and things of that nature, which is a little different now, and mainly because of the access to media and a lot of the world seeing what's going on. But I think it's going to be an interesting discussion dealing with this. I guess this evening. And we're always glad to have him back. Arthur, professor of political science and African-American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor is with us. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back, gentlemen. Glad to be back on Time for Awakening.
Hey, Dr. Taylor, before I pass the mic over to Brother Richard to kind of introduce this topic, how are things out there? I know there's a lot of severe weather going on in the northern part of California, around the San Francisco area. You and your family, you're doing all right?
Yeah, we're doing fine. I'm sitting here about 23 miles outside of San Francisco and Oakland. So it's I'm closer to Napa right now and in between Richmond and Berkeley. So it's a little bit drier over here than over there. In fact, when they had hail and lightning and thunder and, you know, torrential rain and storms in Oakland last week and San Francisco and major flooding, we only got rain and wind. So, it kind of hit some areas harder than others as storms do. But I've seen a lot of devastation in Northern and Southern California. We kind of got a break. If you remember last month, the whole East Coast and Texas and everything back east was frozen. And the only place that was warm was California, not frozen. And so now California is getting its dose of, going through this rain spell. Ironically, we need the rain, but it's doing a lot of damage to trees and things of that sort as well, homes and everything. I think about 50 people have passed, if I'm not mistaken, so I don't want to miss them.
And sorry to hear those and those who are passing. But it's interesting. It's that, if I go by the press symbol, what goes on in California, you got either fires or rain. I mean, that's just, nature just don't play with y'all over there.
That's right. That's right. or earthquakes and the police.
hey, there you go.
We get it all.
Yeah. Professor Taylor, me and Elliot has been, we've always been trying to focus on looking at our political, political arrangement and our party participation. And we wanted to explore William Monroe Trotter and that time period, the time period of the 1870s on, because it seemed to have been a time to kind of really focus on what was going on in the South as far as political participation, what was going on in the North, Trotter being Boston. But and this will be a question to get to this, and I don't know if it's a political philosophy or political thought that came out with Fortin and Trotter pushing it, and that was the Negro Womp. So we will need definition of what that is. But right. Really, could you help us understand what was the in the North, what was the political understanding as it relates to if that's a fair question to ask?
Right, and I think it is because the Negro group, as they were known at that point, you know, we aligned ourselves after 200 years of being here and rejecting, you know, a lot of everything that the European offered, began to align ourselves in the party system once it took in some coherence, because there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that acknowledges parties as a formal institution in U.S. government. So we don't need parties. We don't have to have parties. But as early as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's rivalry, you had a informal and then subsequent a formal party system that emerges, and it becomes cyclical over the next from 1856 until now. So, you know, that's about, you know, 170 years of party politics in American history. And the African-American group, you know, where we had a lot of African-American participation in the pre-revolutionary period in the 18th century, you know, and there's other things I'm thinking about, but I don't want to go back too far. You know, we began to emerge around our own interests locally, like in Boston, Massachusetts, right, with Christmas Addicts, and the way Christmas Addicts' death becomes a symbol for Black unity, and his birthday was celebrated on a regular basis, or his death day, I can't recall, in Boston, as a way of the Black community to continually commemorate and memorialize him, so that they can use that for, you know, ongoing political purposes. And I think that's why we should use Juneteenth in the same way. You know, we should continue to use Juneteenth for modern political purposes to mobilize and keep us unified at local, you know, places throughout the country. Every Black community should be organizing around Juneteenth, because that's the basis of keeping us together. So is Kwanzaa. So are the others that you may or not, you know, recognize, you know. So I think these are, it's important. But in the North, you had an emergent Black leadership class 200 years before the Black Panther Party. And it was mainly in Boston between Prince Hall, who was commemorating Christmas Addicts. So it goes from Christmas Addicts to Prince Hall being the most powerful Black man in Boston at the time, where Boston is taking the scene away from Virginia, where the Jeffersonians are, in New England. And in Black Boston, you know, Prince Hall becomes the foundation of Black Freemasonry in America. But there's a powerful article that I recommend to the audience that you can Google of Christmas. It's called because there's a lot of articles called the Lost or Forgotten Founding Fathers. There's a lot of forgotten white founding fathers out of the 55 that showed up there in 1787 in Philly. But one who wasn't at Philly but was a powerful force in Boston was Prince Hall. So you can Google right now an article that talks about the forgotten Black founding father and how this is so important that the Europeans from that revolutionary generation, even when the Declaration of Independence came up and they had taken out the original anti-slavery clause that was in it, it was Crispus Attucks in all of American history who was the first ever to apply the passage, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." Now that is so important. Jefferson wrote it. Franklin wrote it. John Jay participated, but do you know none of them applied it to society or to any group struggle? They were only using it as a declaration of independence and a war manifesto against King George III and the British Parliament. But I'm trying to help the audience understand something that they don't teach you in school anywhere. anywhere. And that is that black people, from the very beginning when the Declaration of Independence was developed, we took it and gave it meaning that the white folk never intended for it to have in the first place. That is to say that Prince Hall is the founding father who applied the Declaration of Independence to us as a black people first, not a single white man in history. And that should be taught in school. That Prince Hall in Boston, where the American Revolution was there, and he was there, a leader in it. And it is he who applied the passage, the preamble of the Declaration of Independence to black people. No white man did, because the white men who wrote it owned 400 of our ancestors, including Sally Hemings. And listen to this. Sally Hemings had a sister. Sally Hemings' great-granddaughter had a son. That great-granddaughter's son was William Monroe Trotter Sr. Mm. But William Monroe Trotter Jr. is the great-great-grandnephew of Sally Hemings. Yes, Sally Hemings is the great-great-granddaughter, I'm sorry, is the great-great-aunt of William Monroe Trotter's father, who was the original Negro womp. He was the original one. He and even before Trotter and Fortune. am I still on? Because I can't hear you.
Yes.
Okay. I was just checking. So there's a regional element to this, because in Boston you had Prince Hall. You cannot ignore that is the most important thing you can acknowledge about Boston. Way before Malcolm, way before Farrakhan, way before King goes there and works on his doctorate, at Boston. Black Boston had a history that goes back to the American Revolution that gives us our own black democratic tradition that is against the white misinterpretation or reinterpretation of democracy. Real quickly, from the time of the Romans and the Greeks, rather, until the American Revolution is 3,000 years. From the Athenian period of Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato until the American Revolution in 1776, nobody used the word democracy in Western history. Nobody. Native Americans up in New York, up around the Adirondacks and around SUNY, around Purchase, there were a number of Native American tribes that had the practices of democracy that most white people don't know the American founding fathers borrowed from. We act like they were these geniuses who came up here and set up this system. You had a number of Native American tribal orders and arrangements that were politically akin to what the European borrowed from, especially in the East Coast. So then go from Boston and Prince Hall, you go to New York, where there's a long history of black leaders in New York that goes back to the 18th century, fighting against slavery and leading in the march against slavery there that I believe ends in 1822, if I'm not mistaken, but they begin agitating in the 1770s. In my book on black nationalism, I talk about immediately the first group of black men in Boston after Prince, even before Prince Hall, Look it up. Before Prince Hall, there was a petition of black men in Boston slavery who asked to go back to Africa. And that was the first politics of black people. It was back to Africa. When you were taken from your mama and from your homeland, your first politics had to be back to Africa. And it was only after we were colonized in the American context did we become caught up in trying to figure out whether we should separate, integrate, or have a separate development from the larger colonial arrangement. And that to me is part of another element of the conversation. But the regional element is important, because Trotter comes out of Boston. Trotter comes out of the Prince Hall militant tradition. Then you have New York that has its own leadership. Then you go to Philadelphia, and there's Richard Allen and Absalom Jones. And they create, out of Mother Bethel, the first AME church in Philadelphia in 1787. During the same time, the founding fathers are in Philadelphia meeting from June or July up until September 17th. That's the day they stopped meeting and signed the Constitution and closed it and created America. Now, we need to remember that black people were here way before America was America. We were here 150 years before the American Revolution or Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Adams or Hamilton. Black people are proto-Americans. I'm not going to go so far as to talk about us being the original Native Americans, but I am willing to say that we were here before America was a country, and that's just a historical fact, right, as colonies. But in those colonies, I'm saying to you, to answer the regional element of your question, that those three key cities in the Northeast established black leadership immediately within 100 years of our rise. And this is the beauty of black America. What other group could come as we had completely dehumanized, denuded, defrocked, unclothed, shoeless, languagelessness. They took everything from us and our people within 100 years began to engage in formal politics and make petition in English to the white man in his terms. And we when you go back to Boston and Christmas Addicts, that's the beginning of the real background to the American Revolution. And what's so scary about that is John Quincy Adams, the vice president, the second president, the son of the second president, if you look up the history of the Christmas Addicts prosecution, you will see that when they sacked Christmas Addicts, there was a trial in John Quincy Adams, who becomes a liberal and fights for the Amistad captives in 1834. As early as the 1780s, John Quincy Adams called Christmas Addicts a thug. He used that word, thug, in the trial of Christmas Addicts. Look it up. John Quincy Adams, who was liberal, but defended the cops that shot the British soldiers shot Christmas Addicts. He was a 45-year-old mixed-race black man. And this becomes relevant, again, for the regional element, because when we come back to black power later, you're going to see that the real root of this early East Coast black politics comes in conflict with this emergent black politics that comes out of L.A. and Oakland and San Francisco with the Panthers and, the Black Liberation Army, and other groups, but especially the Panthers, trying to offer up national leadership as a black vanguard coming out of Little Oakland, where black folk just got to in 1945. And by 1966, you're yelling black power, even though it comes out of Jackson, Mississippi. The Panthers borrow from Alabama. The Panthers borrow from Jackson and then act like they are the original thinkers of black people, when the truth is the Panthers were really out of line. Or out of their lane in trying to tell these old cities like New York, Boston, and Philadelphia how they're going to be led in the black power era, when New York, and again, I'm a New Yorker, I got my New York hat on right now, my Yankee hat on, with Wu-Tang Clan, right? But there was a regional dimension, and this comes back into play again later with Booker Washington and Du Bois. Du Bois is up in Boston. Du Bois is up in New York City. Booker Washington down in Alabama. So like I'm talking about the Panthers, there's a regional dimension to all black leadership conflicts and all black leadership ideology formations. The West Coast cities out here had a very different trajectory than the black folk from the Deep South that went to Harlem and Philly and Boston and Baltimore and Connecticut and Long Island, where I'm from, during the Negro migration. So our movement becomes important. But what I'm saying, even before we begin migrating, where we were early in the pre-revolutionary period and through the revolutionary period, we formulate our own revolutionary tradition from within it. And we've never fully appreciated it until the sister Nicole Hannah Jones wrote the 1619 Project. Now, there's a lot of historians upset because they wanted to be historically accurate when she was really being rhetorical, not historical. but they won't forgive that. But what she said is, America doesn't understand. We are its democracy. And brothers, that's what I've been trying to tell folk, Elliot and Richard, is that Black people are the main source of democracy in America. Because the white man never meant it for anybody but himself, even when he wrote it. But when we saw it on paper, we made a tradition of it. And I'll be quiet after this. You go from Prince Hall all the way to David Walker. Where's David Walker? He moved from Virginia up to Boston, right? David Walker becomes, right after Prince Hall, it's David Walker and David Walker's appeal, right? And David Walker is you know, speaking to, you know, all kinds of modern issues, right? But he's attacking Jefferson because Jefferson is a racist, and Jefferson, he says, is the brightest and the best and the brightest. What seems to, you know, get lost in this is that as you have these regional elements of Black intellectual and thinking traditions emerging, they are in relationship to the larger social context. But you know, where we live mattered, and different kinds of Black leadership emerged at different times, and they sometimes went into cross purposes. This happens with Booker Washington and Monroe Charter. Monroe Charter literally beats up Booker Washington in 1903 up in Boston when Booker Washington, like Martin Luther King, got stabbed when he went up to Harlem. Well, there's a little book called When Harlem Nearly Killed King. It explains the background to King getting stabbed by Isola Curry, the sister that just died about 4 years ago. That was the issue. Malcolm told them, give Martin Luther King a Harlem welcome. And Martin went up to Harlem, was signing his book, Stride Toward Freedom. And Isola Curry asked him, are you Martin Luther King? He said, yes. And she stabbed him. Booker Washington got beat from trying to expand his leadership from Tuskegee, Alabama, as a regional leader with this white money he was getting from Andrew Carnegie and others to become a national leader. And here's, again, the premise of my point. When he got up to Boston, Booker Washington coming to Boston in the 1880s, where Boston had Black leadership in the 1780s, Monroe tried to literally beat Booker Washington up, him and a bunch of his friends, in what's known as the Boston Riot. And that single fight led to Monroe Trotter being jailed for 30 days, and it angered Du Bois so much, because at that point, up to a point, Booker Washington, Trotter and Du Bois were like brothers, because they both went to Harvard. One, got the Phi Beta Kappa first, that's Trotter, and one was the first Black PhD, that's Du Bois. They dated the same girl at Harvard, and Du Bois ended up with her. But they were friends up to a point. Now, Trotter becomes very difficult for everybody in his personality. So he alienates Booker Washington on one end. He alienates Du Bois on the other end across time. And then he alienates the white NAACP. The NAACP was too white for Trotter. You know, and so a lot of the Black elite looked down on Trotter. But Trotter, when he saw Booker Washington trying to move beyond his regional leadership in Alabama or with white liberal elites who were funding him in the Tuskegee machine, Trotter said, hell no. So Trotter jumped Booker Washington at Faneuil Hall. There was a riot, and that riot led to the famous article in the book, The Souls of Black Folk. In The Souls of Black Folk, written in 1903, the same year as the Boston riot between Trotter and Booker, where Booker was up in Boston, minding Boston's business, he got jumped. And the fallout was a 30-day sentence. Du Bois asked Booker Washington not to press charges. Booker Washington pressed charges. People act like Booker and Du Bois were rivals. They were not rivals. It was Trotter that was Booker Washington's rival. He doesn't get the respect of it, but it was Trotter that was originally Booker Washington's rival, because he called Booker Washington the great traitor. He called them all kinds of nicknames in his newspaper. But it was when they had this fight, and when Du Bois asked Booker not to press charges, and Booker did, and Trotter got a 30-day sentence, That's when Du Bois writes the most famous chapter in the book called The Souls of Black Folk. And that chapter is called Of Mr. Booker T. Washington and Others. And that's where he begins Du Bois to break with Booker, but not before that. It was the riot in Boston. So that goes back to that point about the regional dimension of Black leadership. And so when we're talking about, you know, these tendencies that emerge, like the Negro want, there's a regional dimension to it that you can't, you know, set aside in deference to other emphases.
Now you took us through, and it's a couple of elements, Elliot, that Professor Taylor raised in developing, you know, where does the Negro Womp and Trotter and that regionalist, regional leadership of the North Sea come in. And one of those, as it relates to what later it seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the contest in the electoral politics process and the representation of the people who are being represented and who are saying being represented in electoral. So one thing that I felt the need to clarify, because by you bringing the political philosophy of the Prince Hall, then right. Dave Walker, well, right. I don't know why. You know, you bring in Boston that those individuals who present shape the political, radical Black political philosophy that is centered in, which would later be called race. The thing that jumped out to me was for, if you could, in that region, in Boston, the question of who is this leadership? What is this leadership class? What is this leadership class made of? And we have different distinctions. Is it? And I don't want to project. I wanted to get your feedback. Who do these people that is considered the leadership class within the Boston?
Yeah, the Negro Womps are largely the generation of Trotter's father, not Trotter, and Thomas Fortune, but Trotter's father. He was considered a Negro Womp. Because he felt like, and his son adopted this philosophy too, that the party system deprives Black voters of agency. They felt like by, you know, committing to one party, Black people lose from what the whole party system or both parties could potentially yield. And so as you look at the emergence of the Negro Womp tradition, and again, I'm not trying to project to be an expert on it, but I do attempt to history in my book, but you look at, like, I talk about, for example, the influence of T. Thomas Fortune and other 19th century and early 20th century Black journalists and advocates. I go back, you know, to Maria Stewart, and again in Boston, and you have Maria Stewart. But, you know, again, T. Thomas Fortune was very important, right? If you Google his image, he looks like a white man, kind of like Walter White did with the NAACP in the 1930s and 40s. Where he was so white looking, it was a question as to whether he was white. But he was somebody considered the father of all Black journalism. So he would be the father of the time for awakening and every other thing that could be genetically tied to the first Black newspaper that he had produced. I believe it was called Freedom Journal. Mm-hmm. Freedom Journal. And then the New York Age, I believe, comes something after that. But he edited three papers. And so, you know, to sort of understand the Negro Womps, they were frustrated Black Republicans during the Reconstruction period with the failure of the Reconstruction Republican Party of their own party. This is like us right now, where with their own party allowing the backlash to set in, allowing the era of redemption to backlash against the Reconstruction period in 15. About 12 years. Du Bois felt like if Reconstruction had lasted about 50, 75 years, we wouldn't have needed a Martin Luther King or a modern movement. But because they killed Reconstruction within 12 years, and this is where we really enter political maturity. Again, I think we sometimes fail to understand our circumstances and how we made so much progress under these demonic circumstances. Because the whole time we're doing this, we're being subordinated. We're being imported. We're being deported to Liberia. We're being sent to Haiti. All kind of stuff is happening to black people. They're bringing more folk in from the West Indies, right? And replenishing the earlier crops of black folk, right? And the more the Jamaicans and the Maroons and West Indians they let in, the more militant the black American Negro class become. And there's this emergent resentment in the party system tied to the larger phenomena amongst whites, that where they had the mugwumps. The mugwumps of upset Republicans who were offended that the Republican Party would not live up to its obligations to them. And so Trotter's father was a mixed race Negro. As I said, he was a son of a slave owner, Trotter's father, and a black mother who he owned. And then there's a direct, Google it, there's a direct genealogical connection through her sister to Sally Hemings, not through Sally Hemings herself, but through her sister, who is also one of John Wells' daughters that he had with Sally Hemings' black mama, who he was raping. So he had two daughters with the black mama, and one was Sally, and the other was her sister, and their great-grandchild is William Monroe Trotter.
Now, Professor Terrell, I'm glad that you got to this point, because as I was asking a question about the, flushing out who is this leadership that is carrying this, well, it would be considered radical tradition, political tradition, or really centered black political thought, that Trotter, a father being a mixed race, right? Is it fair to say in that region or in Boston specifically, as Trotter comes along, the son of and gain political power, that there is a mixed race leadership that is predominant?
It was always through the Nation of Islam and Malcolm and Farrakhan Ware in Boston, and they were known as the Black Jews. Yes.
Okay. So I mean.
Who else? W.E.B. Du Bois, Boston. Like the light-skinned elite, absolutely. It ran, with the exception of Khalid Muhammad, it ran through the Nation of Islam for most of its history.
Mm. And I think that I just wanted to bring that out, because we see that over a period, that the group, and I don't want to, it's not about the color, it's about carrying a leadership role.
Right.
As we're dealing with the political consequences of being, of trying to get resources out of these, as you say, these parties that are not really anchored in the structure of America. They're private organizations that are, and we're trying to participate in them when they were excluding us, or they are controlled by others. So that's one thing that I wanted to clarify, and I appreciate that we see that Trotter comes out of that grouping of social grouping. Now, the other thing that we raise is that, and I think it's important just for the context in developing as we deal with this politics, is the importance of black newspapers. You mentioned Fortin, you mentioned Trotter, we mentioned and talking about Trotter. Both of them are newspaper publishers. How important, in relationship to this political tradition, is the communication newspaper instrument perpetuating that?
Excellent, because as early as the Freedom Journal emerges, right, if you look at the history of, again, Black Boston, this is in my book on Black nationalism, Black Boston is also the source of this, this whole tradition of independent sort of oriented politics that emerges. Through black writing, it was Frederick Douglass's North Star, right? That comes after Garrison's leadership emerges in Boston. But if you study close the history of Black Boston, you'll see that they were the power, not the white abolitionists. It was Black Boston that funded and financed Garrison's, it wouldn't be what we would call a newspaper today. It's some kind of, two-page pamphlet, right?
Yeah.
But for the time, it was with the emergence of the printing press, the new, you know, inability now to communicate. And this is very important that what you're talking about, is because we can't take for granted that, you know, people weren't using the internet then, right? They weren't using TV or phones, right? So, I mean, Lincoln was considered an innovative president, like Trump was using tweet for using, you know, Morse code to conduct conversations with his generals. But that was new technology, and that technology and the various stages of technological development as we emerge as a people remains important all the way through, from the radio to the, you know, to the speaker, I mean, to the, you know, microphone, to, you know, to all the way up to the internet and TV, right? But I want to get back to one of the historical points I wanted to make, because again, these news outlets, especially these written papers or prints, they documented all of what was emerging in the 1880s and 90s. They informed Du Bois's book Black Reconstruction. They document the things that begin to happen to Black folk as they, you know, continue to emerge in the disappointment of Reconstruction, which is about 1877. So by the 1880s, 1890s, the lynchings are beginning. Right? They weren't doing much lynching in the 1860s because they still had us in chains. But once we got free, they began the lynching. So this is a whole nother stage of our reality. So those articles, these Northeast-based newspapers in Boston, where Frederick Douglass is, Freedom's Journal, in New York Age, they're documenting everything. You know, when we start migrating north, they document the beginnings of the Negro migration. They are the ones that tell Black folk. Right, that's where the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier, the New York Amsterdam News, and a bunch of less well-known Black papers throughout Black America, there were always journalists, because writing was so important for us to articulate our position. And that's why I think it's so important that we continue to understand that we have to stay on the forefront of technological development going forward into the 21st century, so we can continue to use these mechanisms to continue to advocate our ancient grievance against this wickedness that we face. But I just want to establish one more historical point. So these papers begin to documenting the lynchings. They begin to document the emergence of Booker Washington. And they document, for example, in 1898, the killing of a Black man who was a postal worker in South Carolina, and his two-year-old daughter, a white mob, killed a postal worker, a Black man, walking with his daughter, who was 2 years old. And Black papers began to tell of these atrocities, these demonic practices carried out mainly by the Irish and the Scotch-Irish of the South. Not all whites, but mainly a particular demonic inclination that most Black folk don't understand, Brother Richard, and this is a regional phenomenon too. The study of the Scotch-Irish, you want to understand why they lynched us? You want to know where the word Klan comes from? It's Scotch. What is Trump? Scotch. What was John C. Calhoun? Scotch. What was Ronald Reagan? Scotch-Irish. There's a long history from Bill O'Reilly and Rupert Murdoch all the way back to William F. Buckley and Ronald Reagan that has an obsession with Black people. But the Southeast, where the white cracker comes from, the cracker was a Scotch-Irish person, not a British one, not a German one, not a French one. And they were particularly bitter and violent because they were such an oppressed group themselves in their own history in relationship to the British crown. And so that becomes part of the reality. Is this reality that, you know, whites in the South adopt a particular kind of violence. But we as students of this history have not understood that it was a particular regional violence. Black folk wouldn't be lynched everywhere. Black folk would be lynched in one region from the 1870s to the 1940s. It's mainly, not absolutely, but mainly a Southern phenomenon. And consequently,
You got to understand the nature of that racism. The next book I hope to write is called Fighting the Irish. Why? Because understand the race riots that happened from the 1870s on. It's the Irish doing it to us. It's not all white people. It's two groups of white people. And it ain't even both Irish. The Irish that are Catholics are up in Boston, New York, Philadelphia. The Scotch-Irish is the cracker. He ain't no Catholic. He's a Presbyterian Protestant. And they were the ones that hung us and lynched us. And they are the ones that, the word clan is a Scotch-Irish word. You don't understand, brothers. You don't understand the nature of racism in America. We paintbrush all white folk with racism, when the truth is the worst white people are the ones we lived among and still live among. Study the history of the Scotch-Irish. You'll find out everyone from John C. Calhoun to Ronald Reagan to the white people who moved over during the homesteading period, all the way up to, you know, up to modern politics. And so what happened is the black folk had this thing called the Negro Womp. And this becomes an analogy to the white Republicans, who are called the Mug Womps. And they refused to back their party because of their failure in 1884 to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And so black folks said, we're not supporting our party no more. And they withdrew themselves from their party. So as we move on in this discussion and move more towards the party dynamic, I want to make clear that what black people's strategy has always been in this particular genealogy was not to move toward the other party, but it was simply to break up with your own party. It's something called de-alignment and realignment. In party politics, de-alignment is like breaking up with your girlfriend. Realignment is like breaking up with your girlfriend and going with somebody else right away. That's realignment. You de-align and you realign. That's you know what I'm saying? So you might see George Wallace or Strom Thurmond in 48 and 68 break away from the Democrats. See, that's called de-alignment, when they created those independent racist parties against us in 48 and 68. But they did not join the Republicans. See, that would have been a realignment. So what black people have been the best group in American history of doing, other than that group right there, we've been the best group at de-aligning from our party. Nobody comes second. And this is something that people don't understand about us. We broke from our main party that we were with from 1856 until 1964, 108 years, we were solidly Lincoln Republicans until these agitators like the Mugwumps and another group I talk about in my dissertation that I really recommend for a deep scholarly treatment of this issue. Look at my dissertation. It's called Black Politics in Transition, from Protest to Politics to Political Neutrality, where I'm trying to argue for political neutrality against the two major parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I document 200 years of black independent party politics, where black folk with their own parties, even up to 1964, with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the Adams County Freedom Organization that the Panthers stole their name from, to show us that even in Fannie Lou Hamer's time, black folk were creating their own parties, and we, since 1974, haven't tried to do anything. We got a bunch of folk all over the country with 15 people following them talking about they're a new independent black party, and that's ain't doing nothing for nobody but wasting our time. Look all over, Google it. Google Black Independent Party. You're going to find 50 little dudes with fiefdoms following them with 20 people talking about we starting a new black party. But nobody's serious about it. Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker was serious in 1964 when they went with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. We ain't did nothing like that since. The only thing that comes close is in Chicago in 1983 when the white Democrats of Chicago endorsed Jane Byrne over the black candidate. Blacks in Chicago, like Tim Black, who just died recently at the age of 104 years old. There's a new book on him. Please read the story of Tim Uel Black, T-I-M-U-E-L. This was an elder who was the teacher of both Larry Hoover and John Fort, the two leaders of the gangs of Chicago, the two main gangs who are still, these two men are still alive. In Chicago, you've heard Kanye keep talking about Larry Hoover, Larry Hoover, Larry Hoover. Well, the other one's Jeff Fort, the Gangster Disciples and L. Rookins. Guess who was both of their teacher? A black man named Tim Black. He just died at 104 years old. This black man and Conrad Worrell and Bob Starks with a K, who is still alive in Chicago, they got Harold Washington to leave Congress, come back to Chicago, run as mayor in Chicago against the Democratic Party within the Democratic Party. Here you have another, here's another black strategy that we used to use. Ella Baker did it in 64. Fannie Lou did it in 64. They beat the white racist Mississippi Democrats at their own game and got played by LBJ. But that was the strategy. At least they did it. They didn't break from the Democrats. They beat the Democrats from within. And this is what Harold Washington and these Tim Black and these others did in the 1980s, is they don't break from the Democrats. They beat the Democrats in Chicago, and that launches the modern period of black politics. But we didn't learn nothing from it. We end up, you know, Obama sees it. He flies his butt into Chicago, leaves New York, runs to Chicago, and all of a sudden he wants to be in Chicago. And this launches the modern period of black politics, I argue in my book, that when Washington emerges, because of this independent, with, it's called independence within, the independence within party strategy, as opposed to a separate breakaway strategy. But our ancestors, I'm trying to say quickly, tried all kinds of strategies. And Haynes Walton Jr., who was one of the most profound black political scientists, he was out of Savannah State, then he was up at University of Michigan. He's now gone. He is the best student of black political parties. Google Haynes Walton Jr., H-A-N-E-S, Walton Jr., black parties, and watch all of the books he's written on black parties, and he shows you pictures of all the, what I'm trying to say, graphs and charts of all the black parties we created from the 1800s up into the 1900s. And it's astounding how many we tried to create back then, and we haven't done anything serious. And I thought Farrakhan was serious when he talked about using the Million Man March to create a third force. And of course, Farrakhan didn't live up to that.
Richard, I was going to turn it to you, because Professor Taylor laid out and contextualized.
Let me throw something in here, Professor Taylor, because Richard raised something that was important even now. And it's an important tool to us organizing is media. Now, at that time, you, Trotter, Douglas, and I think Richard told me that Douglas' son was also involved as a Negro Womp. So you had media people that was doing mass media at that time that used it to organize, such as Trotter. Trotter was came from an elite class of black people, but he didn't think like a lot of the elite blacks. So the Guardian paper, according to history, was used to organize. When he confronted, and you know, according to history, and you can weigh in on this also, because, this is what you teach. I think that a lot of the anger that Trotter had, and Du Bois to a degree, was fueled when Booker T. Washington made that Atlanta Compromise speech. And he said all of these things in reference to his people, that all we need to do is learn carpentry and learn how to farm. Although black people knew carpentry and knew how to farm when we were enslaved, we didn't have to learn that. So when he was saying that we're not interested in public office, any higher things to control, mechanisms to govern our people, we're not interested in that. We just want to learn how to get along with whites and, you know, have the schools of carpentry and farming. Okay. So that was sufficient for whites. But I think it really got the ire of Trotter and Du Bois.
And that's the irony of Trotter, is he is one of the talented 10th, the black elite. He's, you know, probably the first of Du Bois's, you know, conceptions of it. You know, I mean, he's a Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard. And don't forget, Carter G. Woodson is the second black man to get the PhD from Harvard University, and he's of a different orientation than Booker Du Bois, and far more of an unavowed nationalist. Mm-hmm. Carter Woodson, as I understand it, Carter Woodson was. And so, you know, you have these emergent Black traditions. And of course, there's a lot going on with Negro women and the National Negro Women's Movement and different individual Black women leaders like Ida B. Wells. Barnett emerges, right, with the NAACP. In fact, she and Du Bois, if you Google the founders of the NAACP, you'll see how white it is. The NAACP was never a Black organization until about the 1950s. The NAACP, created in 1909/10, was a bunch of white people and Du Bois and
Ida B. Wells.
And so I think Ida B. Wells is the other person. That's it. So we were a minority. And if you listen to the word, it's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, not the National Association of Colored People. That would have been what Carter was doing. I'm sorry, what Trotter was doing with his own Niagara Movement project. But when the white liberals took over and created, and they were mainly Jews and socialists, and I'm not anti-Semite, but that's just the truth. They were mainly Jews and socialists. Look them up. Mary White Ovington. You can look at Oswald Villard Garrison. The main founder of the NAACP was Oswald Villard Garrison. His granddaddy was William Lloyd Garrison. There's a direct umbilical cord from the Garrisonian Boston abolitionist movement to the modern white-led NAACP. It was his granddaddy. How are you going to disconnect those two? The NAACP is the grandchild of white abolitionism, not Black militancy. Black folk created their own tradition. And this is what Trotter represents. He is neither down with Booker or with Trotter of Du Bois for too long. He respects aspects of Booker, but he didn't think Booker had any business up in Boston. He didn't believe in this uplift ideology. In the same way that Booker's idea of not engaging in political engagement implicated, because again, as literate, Harvard-educated Black men and women, they were advocating for equality rights for Blacks. And I think sometimes a lot of our modern-day Black intellectuals like to dismiss uplift ideology. And you know, Kevin Gaines does this with a book called Uplift the Race that I try to attack in my own book on Black nationalism, where he tries to trivialize, you know, the class dimension between Black folk. But a number of scholars have documented that Black Americans, throughout their history, their Black elite and their Black bourgeoisie, I'm not talking about their boule, but their Black bourgeoisie, have always been more committed to them and their uplift than any other groups has. Hell, when the Jews were being sent around the world in boats to trying to avoid the Nazis, the American Jews sent them back to their deaths. Look it up. They sent them back from Argentina, and they sent them back from America, from out here in California. They sent a boatload of Jews back to Europe, and they all went back to countries where the Nazis killed them. The American Jews didn't care nothing about what happened to the people in the Holocaust until the 1970s, historically speaking, in terms of its importance as a historical symbol. When I say they don't care about it, they didn't care about it politically. Even if they were devastated as a people by their Shoah, as they call it, they begin to use it in the 1970s for the first time, because from the 1940s to the 70s, the American Jew didn't want to have anything to do with the European Jews, the white European Jews. And so I'm saying that as an example to show you Black Americans elites like Du Bois, like Booker Washington, like Trotter, like Mary Shad Carey, like Anna Julia Cooper, who lives longer than Du Bois, and who's Du Bois's main ally in D.C., where she's a highly venerated Ph.D. school teacher, as high as she could get at that time. Anna Julia Cooper is the one that told Du Bois to answer T.H. Dixon's racist Klansman and the leopard spot with the souls of Black folk. So Du Bois writes the souls of Black folk because Anna Julia Cooper said Black people need an answer to these two racist things that are written by T.H. Dixon that become known as the Klansman with a C. Like this again, that Southern Scotch Irish hatred of us, and the leopard spots. And if you look that up, you'll know that that's what W.D. Griffith used as the script for the famous motion picture film Birth of a Nation, that is broadcast in the era of the 19 teens, at the turn of the 20th century. And again, this is about new technology. Now we're talking about motion picture film. About 1999, I think they had done the previous century of most top 50 most important films. And now, Birth of a Nation was
number one.
Number one or number seven. I don't want to exaggerate. It was either number one or number seven.
No, it was number one. It was number one.
Because of its early, right? Because it was the early motion picture film. It had blackface and it had real slaves. It had a white Jesus at the end. I mean, Birth of a Nation, people don't know this, ends with white Jesus in heaven with only white people around him. That's the demonic thing. That's how Birth of a Nation ends. It ends with white Jesus surrounded by white people in heaven in white robes, and then and all of us go to hell. So this comes back to our conversation with Trotter. And I think we would call Trotter instead of a Negro wump, we might call him a neo-Negro wump, because he's the second generation behind his daddy. If you look it up, his daddy was the first Negro to ever work for the U.S. Postal Service and was made $4,000 in 2 years. And that's a whole lot of money. And he bought a bunch of land and he got filthy rich. And when he dies, William Monroe Trotter becomes a millionaire because of his father's holdings. But his father got it because someone allowed him to work in the Postal Service because of his light skin and mixed race heritage. So he was able to save money. And that becomes the seed money for the family's wealth. Now, again, the mugwumps are white Republicans who were mad and didn't want their 1884 candidate. The black mugwumps the black wumps emerged more specifically with regard to their refusal to enforce the Civil Rights Acts of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Now, let me be clear. This is what I see happening right now. The way that we're having this racial backlash with MAGA, there's a good analogy between the collapse of Reconstruction in the 1870s and the collapse right now of, you know, pretty much a civil rights movement coalition with the Democratic Party, because of the ways in which they aren't able to get key legislation passed, like the George Floyd bill, you know, a police accountability bill, the John Lewis, those things that are black specific, Biden has not been able to get. But things that will incidentally, like Obama says, a rising tide lifts all boats. Obama and Biden have the same disposition towards black folk. They ain't doing nothing specific, but they'll do something that will benefit us too. So these betrayals has a precedent in the black. Why are we talking about these people? Let's ask that question. Why are we talking about the Negro wants? And again, I mentioned a group that you should look up. They're not, but it's Haynes Walton's work where you can find it about the black and tan Republicans. You won't find a lot on Google about the black and tan Republicans, but you will in the research of Haynes Walton, because he documents them. And the black and tan Republicans were Negroes who broke away from the Republican Party, much like the Negro wumps. And brother Richard, I don't know if there's a regional dimension between the Negro wumps and the black and tans. I don't know if it's, you know, the same word for the same group, different words for the same group, or I don't know how the Negro wump relate to the black and tan Republicans. But what I'm trying to say is they're the same creature. The Negro wump, and we had a black and tan Republican Party about the 1870s until about the 1890s. They called the black and tans. So these, for the most part, apart from abolition of slavery, and that was really because of John Brown, not because of Abraham Lincoln, and because of what Du Bois documents in Black Reconstruction, is the reality that we also are not taught, like we didn't get taught about Prince Hall. We weren't taught what Du Bois puts in Black Reconstruction, the details that 200,000 black men picked up guns and killed white men. How the hell is that not a revolution during a civil war? And that's what my friend Errol Henderson, who's a professor at Penn State University, his book is called The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized. And he theorizes the book and talks about the role of Du Bois's Black Revolution thesis in the book Black Reconstruction, where Du Bois says when 190,000 black men took up guns, like in the movie Glory, the 54th Infantry with Denzel and Wesley Snipes and Morgan Freeman, that great movie, that was a reality. Even with Matthew whatever his name is, the little white actor, you know, even his character was a real character. And it was that time period, you know, when black men took up guns, that Du Bois said a revolution happened within the Civil War. So instead of us thinking Abraham Lincoln freed us, we would understand those black men with guns is what freed us. And then Du Bois says the second step to our revolution was when our elders and children and women walked off the plantation when the 200,000 men picked up the gun. So there was a 500,000 people strike, and Du Bois calls it the general strike. He says black folk, forget Communist Party theories of general strike. You want to see a real general strike in history? Look at what the Negro does to get free. So Du Bois says we engage in a general strike, and that general strike was to walk away with our labor from the plantations, which is just what John Brown was trying to do. John Brown wasn't trying to start no slave uprising like Nat Turner and them. John Brown's philosophy was chase the slaves off the plantation so the white men won't be able to enslave their labor. And so that becomes part of a gradualist approach. But as you move forward, when we move from, say, abolition politics, which is a lot of the advocacy in the newspapers that we were talking about earlier in those early 19th century papers, as time moves forward and comes closer to the 20th century, we're talking about the Booker period. And the Booker period is 1881 to 1895, right? And then from Booker, you know, Booker comes, you know, after Booker dies, Garvey comes, and wants to be the next Booker, right? I tried to be clear earlier to say that Du Bois and Booker Washington's original differences were not philosophical. Harold Cruz is my spirit animal. Harold Cruz, who wrote The Crisis of Negro Intellectual. And he is the clearest thinker in the world in history on everything I'm talking about. In fact, everything I'm saying, I ain't doing nothing but parroting Harold Cruz. From an article he wrote in 73 called Black and White, The Next Stage, from The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual in 1967, and from a less well-known book in 1987 called Plural But Equal. And Plural But Equal is where he's saying black folk can't be looking for integration. They should be pursuing plurality as a strategy, which means don't become a part of any one party. Cruz felt like the logic of everything black folk had done since the days of the, you know, of Freedom's Journal newspaper from the 1820s up until the 1960s and 70s, for 150 years, Cruz says everything we are doing in black American history in terms of politics only, not religion, not culture, not holidays, but in terms of electoral politics, he says all of our politics should be leading to one thing and one thing only. And he says this in the book, Plural But Equal, in 1987, that if we don't realize an independent party strategy by the year 2000, we will have reached the end of black politics. Let me say that again slow. Cruz said in 1987, in the book Plural But Equal, which is not as famous as his earlier book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, but in the Plural But Equal, he is thinking about party. He's thinking about regions. He's thinking about black folk need to become independent of the Democratic Party. He is writing in 87, blacks had just been Democrats since 1964. So it's still relatively new. And as I was saying earlier, when we talked about de-alignment, we're the only group who used to belong to a party for over 100 years, and now we're in the opposite party and chase the racists who used to hang us and lynch us out of that party into the other party. There's not an equivalence of that with any group in American history. We are bad. We broke from our party of Lincoln between the Negro Warmth and the Black and Tans and all those independent parties that Haynes Walton documents up until the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Chicago. Those are independent party strategies. And Cruz says, in Plural But Equal, if we don't, the full logic of all black politics should end up in a party. What he meant by that was, a party ain't just one thing. A party is a multi-issued, a platform, right? We can talk about health, or we can talk about marriage in the family. We can talk about international travel. We can talk about Pan-Africanism. We can talk about nationalism. We can talk about socialism. We can talk about LGBTQI. We can talk about guns. We can talk about liberals. We can talk about MAGA blacks. We can have every stripe of black person under the sun come to these conventions or party, forums to flesh out our politics. This is Cruz. Every stripe of black politics should be in the party, not just a black revolutionary idea. Because again, as Brother Richard suggested earlier, the idea of a black party is seen as radical, and it ain't. It's actually very conservative to become a political party. I don't know why we think a party is revolutionary when one of the parties, conservative. The parties ain't revolutionary. Where is there a revolutionary party? The Black Panther Party was a revolutionary party, but they weren't a political party. So where is it? There's no such thing as a revolutionary political party. That's like saying a revolutionary church. Most churches ain't revolutionary. They conservative. Like a revolutionary cop. You ain't gonna find no revolutionary cop. Because they're cops. Some things you can't be revolutionary in, right?
Dr. Taylor, what we're going to do, we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we got some callers that have been holding on. I know they probably got some questions or comments. But when we come back, I want to touch on two areas, after we go to the callers. The formation of the Niagara Movement and why. And also the 1924 Negro Sanhedrin Conference. Now, let me say this before we break. And Richard can chime in if he got a little more on it. To use the paper, the Guardian, to organize black men who was opposed to Washington's accommodation stance, according to history. And the response to the call, it says 29 men from 14 different states gathered in Buffalo, but they traveled over to Canada to form the Niagara Movement. The first black organization that challenged Washington's power. And the first black-oriented civil rights organization formed in the 20th century. It says during the meeting, the group drew up a manifesto demanding voting rights for African Americans, the end of racist segregation and discrimination, better health care, better housing, and schools for the nation's black population. So we see here
Let me say this real quick, Elliot.
Go ahead.
That's not integration. That ain't the same thing as integration. They just want a separate reality here without having to be a part of anything.
Exactly.
We shouldn't read too much into that struggle. That's why the Niagara Movement breaks with the white NAACP because they don't want integration.
Okay.
They want separate development. They want something in between separatism and integration. Something like, the idea of the New Republic of Africa, where we exist in the South in five states here in America, like the Mormons do in Utah, or the Samoans do in Samoa, or the Puerto Ricans do in Puerto Rico, that we would be Black America within America, having five states. Tupac believed in this, but I know we want to get to a break, so I'll stop, and we can come back to all these different people that advocated for the Republic of New Africa or different forms, because King talked about voluntary segregation. Du Bois got kicked out the NAACP when he talked about temporary separation.
Well, and see, that's what I want to say for the break, is when Du Bois and try to form this organization, and later on, the whites that helped form or put the framework together for the NAACP was formed by those men. But when whites got involved, I think they were trying to derail. Not I think. It was.
Absolutely.
They were derailing what was started in the Niagara Movement.
They first were trying to derail Booker Washington, because Booker Washington taught the five separate, the implication of part of Booker Washington's philosophy was also racial separation. Manning Marable has written an article about Booker Washington as a black nationalist because Booker Washington saying, we don't want to be with you white folk. We don't want you. He said, give us our separate development. He says we should be as united as the fist when it comes to economic development and capitalism and Negro education, but we should be as separate as the five fingers when it comes to being black and white friends. So Booker, implicated in Booker, is a racial separatist idea, and this is why the white NAACP up in New York rises up against Booker, and they meet in Harlem when the Harlem Renaissance, it becomes the main stage where all the black folk have migrated, and every major black organization in America headquarters itself in Harlem. And this is why you have to read Harold Cruse again and again. You got to read the Negro, the Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. You have to read Revolution, Rebellion or Revolution. You have to read the article called Black or White, Lessons for the Last Stage, because in those articles and books is where Cruse offered deep theoretical understanding of the history and cycles of Black Party ID, Black Party breaks, Black Party independence, and what those historical stages should have taught the Black Panther Party. The Panthers' misstep was that they end up trying to be national leaders and vanguards instead of simply developing a Black political party in Oakland and then running a cross section of issues from labor to health to police brutality to nutrition to, you know, whatever else we thought were our policy preferences. The Panthers should have laid out a Black Panther Party platform, and they finally do in 1973 when they Lane Brown and Bobby Seale run, but they didn't learn the lessons. And this is Cruz's point. If the Panthers had learned the lessons that as a new phenomena in the West Coast that emerged between 45 and 61, you ain't got no business telling those old cities with old histories to do what to do. Let them do what they do. What you do in Oakland is you develop the Black Panther Party in Oakland. And the Panthers finally figured this out in 1972, where Huey turned all of their focus on electoral politics, didn't he? No more revolution, right? The breakfast program, the program to feed the children, the sickle cell testing. And then and then both Bobby and Elaine Brown run as Democrats. And I thought that was a fatal, and I'm in Oakland, right? I've been in Oakland for 20 years. I teach at University of San Francisco. I know this history better than just about anybody who didn't live it. That's a lot of people that didn't live it. So that means I know a lot more than a whole lot of people. So I want to be humble in saying that. But I want to be clear that, you know, this is a regional phenomena as well, but it's also a lesson lost on how all these conflicts, like between Booker and Trotter and New York and, you know, Boston, you know, these regional power bases of Black power, the Panthers, Howard Cruse says, got it right when they finally decided, let's colonize Oakland in a positive way for our Black politics. And this is called Howard Cruse's Theories of Black Cities. This is the theory. It's called the Theory of Black Cities, that wherever we have 30% or more of a Black population, we can have complete power in those counties or cities if we stay local without trying to be revolutionaries for everybody. Just focus on Birmingham. Just focus on Montgomery. Just focus on Toronto. Just focus on Newport News. Just focus on Philly. Don't Richard try to lead Oakland. Don't James try to lead Philly. Richard will lead Philly. Elliot, you can work with him in Philly. I'll be in Oakland working with the folk out here in Oakland. And what the Panthers were trying to do was create examples. This is what Fred Hampton was trying to do in Chicago. He was trying to teach the people models and examples so they could build confidence, not so they can be revolutionary nationalist leaders, but so that they can also develop their own local projects. And that's part of our problem, Brother Elliot. We're too busy yelling Black power, screaming it across the bow, instead of being quiet locally and developing ourselves. And this is what Booker Washington did, I think, get right when he says, basically, cast your buckets where you are. Because like you said, who were the farmers? Who knew sowing and reaping seeds? Who knew the seasons? Who knew when it was going to get cold and when you had to rake the corn? Who knew how to milk the cows and slay the hogs? Who knew how to till the land? We had done it for centuries. So it was the white group that needed training and education. So Booker's trying to use our strengths. And he's saying our strength is our manual capacities here in the South and our numerical capacities. So Booker was trying to get folks to stay there. But he also, it was selfish too, because he knew if they left, he would lose his power base. And this happened to him. It happened to Martin Luther King during the Black 1940s Negro migration. When Martin Luther King emerges as a Negro leader in 1956 with the bus boycott, Black folk had already left the South. Most people don't think about that. When King emerges around the bus boycott in 55, we had already left in 45. So when King, like Booker, is talking to Black folk, he's talking to Black folk, Brother Richard, to go back to your original question about the Black folk that have left the Southern region and have moved into cities of North and West And now this creates a new racial moment, because when we move in all the receiving cities, the devil was there waiting for us, telling us we could not come.
That's why it's important that we know our struggle and know history. These things are important. That way we don't have to keep repeating the same mistakes and doing the same thing over and over again. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we got some callers that have been holding on, and we'll get right to them. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with author, professor of politics and African-American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor. We'll be right back.
With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commits You Black family. To join your interconnected Commits You Black communities, escape the digital plantation now. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
A new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we are getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationist people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality, and they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
And know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. See, brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda.
Whites are expert game players in their contests to maintain absolute power. One of the time-honored gimmicks is to point to individual blacks who've achieved recognition. But look at Ralph Bunche. Think about Lena Horne or Mary Anderson. Look at Jackie Robinson. They made it as one of those who has made it. I would like to be thought of as an inspiration to our young, but I don't want them lied to. Name them for me. The examples of blacks who made it. For virtually everyone you name, I can give you a sordid piece of factual information on how they have been mistreated, humiliated. Not being able to fight back is a form of severe punishment.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
An Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening, wait a minute, it's 8:36 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, author, professor of political science and African-American studies at the University of San Francisco, Dr. James Lance Taylor. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Montgomery, Alabama.
Thank you for picking my call this evening. I'm listening and taking notes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Thank you so very much.
Okay, no question or comment?
Not tonight.
Okay. Talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
Right.
All right, peace.
Let's go to Toronto, 647. Toronto.
Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, sir.
I had a question for Dr. Taylor. I wanted to know, did he ever hear any stories about the battles that Harold Cruz and Walter Rodney used to have when they both taught at Ann Arbor, Michigan? That's one question. And the second question is, could you talk about the role? I didn't listen to the whole interview, but could you talk about the role of Hubert Harrison? I think he was from St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands or Dutch Virgin Islands. St. Croix, I don't know if that's where Tim Duncan, but he was he was one of our greatest intellectuals. Could you deal with those two questions, sir?
Absolutely. I'll do the first one, the second one first. And that is, unfortunately, Jeff Perry just died, the great white historian who wrote the definitive book on Hubert Henry Harrison. And I'm holding it up here. It says, Hubert Harrison, the voice of Harlem radicalism, 1883 to 1918. See, this is a part of that same intellectual movement. Talking about Trotter and his connections to the earlier generation, like his father, is really looking at the seeds of an orientation that emerges amongst Black folk towards some kind of independence within the American situation. And Harrison, coming from the West Indies, again, you know, he and others come. He's considered the Black Socrates because he was a real brain trust behind what Garvey becomes. In fact, he introduces Garvey to Harlem. And there's a number of other men like Asa Philip Randolph, a number of their contemporaries were, you know, all leading organizations. But the key to all of them is they were all in Harlem. Harlem was the meeting place of all Black America. It wasn't that New York was important. It was just that they made it important. And they made Harlem important, and they created the Renaissance and the New Negro Movement. But even within those, there were ethnic tensions. He's West Indian. Garvey was West Indian. Harold Cruse is clear that there was a Black American versus ethnic West Indian tension, like Attos and the foundational Black American phenomenon now, in Harlem. There's a whole chapter of it in the Crisis of the Negro Intellectual about the problem of Black American Negroes from the South as they migrated, not wanting to line up with Garvey's Unia in the African Orthodox Church, which is overwhelmingly Jamaican supported. And then Cruz is clear that Garvey, that there's a different element that emerges in the Garvey line. I only can mention Howard Cruz's relationship at Michigan. I never met Cruz, unfortunately, but my very best academic friend is a direct student of his who was at Michigan when he got his PhD. Haynes Walton was, that's why Haynes Walton is important. Haynes Walton and Cruz weren't friendly to each other. They, you know, Cruz had a cantankerous kind of independent, leading, you know, just kind of like Trotter, just kind of a independent personality. And that's the tragedy of Trotter is when you read about Trotter's life in the definitive book on Trotter, you'll see that his, you know, his sticky personality is why he ended up, you know, the book is by Kerry Greenridge. It's called Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter. And you know, she talks about his difficult personality. And that was true about, you know, Cruz. It was different about Harrison. A lot of these men didn't have time in that time in history to be talking and playing games and being nice and friendly. They weren't feminized like the modern men is. They were dealing with World War I, World War II lynchings. They were dealing with poverty. They were dealing with the Great Depression. They were dealing with all of these dislocations in their social reality. So they didn't have time for all this, you know, effeminate way of responding to the modern crisis. And so, you know, Cruz had a personality that just wasn't bubbly. You can see him in a few documentaries where he's talking, and he didn't like, for example, going into a room with a bunch of Black nationalists or Black Marxists or Black revolutionaries and just hearing all the talk, all the running of their mouths about revolution, everybody ego tripping and showing off. That's why I don't like to be bothered with a lot of alignments of Black groups, you know, especially anybody that claims to be a student of Malcolm X. Elliot, I don't know about you, brother, but I tend to stay away from folk that are students of Malcolm X because I'm an independent student of Malcolm X. But those, you know, like, you know, they tend to be so sectarian and want you to join their interpretation of Malcolm in the same, like Malcolm becomes doctrine in the same way that Marx becomes the main, you know, point that the Trotskyites and the Communist Party USA and the Democratic Socialists of America all can't get along around socialism, right? So Harrison is offering up radical left-oriented socialist critiques, absolutely. And he didn't like the way Garvey becomes this personality, a cult of personality around Garvey, because he was more about, you know, challenging inequalities and racial dislocations. But again, Asa Philip Randolph is very important at this time, you know, with the Defender, I believe it is, his journal is, and he's advocating and he's organizing around labor. So, that, you know, part of what's getting lost in everything I'm trying to say also has to do with what Cruz was saying. The Reconstruction period, he said,
So Cruz said we have several fronts in our history that keep coming back in cycles. And it all goes back to everything we're talking about. He says there is the economic front, there's the political front, and there is the economic, political, the economic, political, and the cultural. And the Harlem Renaissance would be the cultural front, the cultural moment. The book, the Reconstruction period of Branch, K. Bruce, Hiram Rebels, those black congressional leaders and black local leaders during the short Reconstruction period, that would be the first political cycle. The civil rights movement in the 60s would be another civil rights cycle, but it's not an economic cycle or a cultural cycle necessarily, even though you have economic arguments being made and cultural elements in, you know, the civil rights movement and black arts and black power, for example. The point is, Harlem was clearly a cultural thing. Booker was kind of the counter to the political moment, right? And so then the economic moment comes under Booker. So you have the political moment under Reconstruction. You have the economic moment under Booker. After Booker is Garvey, and that's the cultural moment. So that 30-year cycle, that those three stages, Cruz says we should be understanding how those cycles, one political, one economic, one cultural, might be the bullet we put in the chamber at a given time, but we ain't using all three all the time, and we can't be confusing when that bullet should be used. That's what happens in black politics. We be using the cultural gun when we should be using the political gun or partisan gun. We be using the economic gun when we should be using the cultural gun bullet, not gun bullet. So what Cruz is arguing is that we keep misreading the stages at where we are. So where is Black Lives Matter? So if you understand what I'm saying, he says that when black power comes, this is what Cruz says, at the time you get from those three stages, from Reconstruction, the political, Booker Washington, the economic, Garvey and the cultural, the next thing that comes is the Great Depression and World War II. So that 20 years between Great Depression and World War II, all of the data of those three stages, political, economic, and cultural, gets lost. So when the Black Power generation emerges just after World War II, what do they say? Black Power. And all they're saying is what their grandmama said 30 years ago when they called it the New Negro Movement. But because they did not understand their connection in the 60s in Harlem or Oakland or Philly or Boston or New York, to the earlier moment of the Harlem Renaissance period, what I'm trying to say, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, is the Black Power, according to Harold Cruz, was simply the restatement of the new Negro by the next generation. And they didn't understand their connection to Garvey and how the Great Depression and World War II confused Black history because of the desperation of those times and the change of priorities of those times. And so we lose the information. But up until, so, and this is what else Cruz says. He says we went into World War II Garveyites, even with Hubert Harrison and Asa Philip Randolph and Du Bois and all those disagreeing groups in Harlem. Cruz says we went into the Renaissance, we went into World War I with the new Negro mindset. We come out with the integration mindset. Look at this. We go in. That's my wall. That's Garvey. We go in with Garvey into World War II. We come out with I Have a Dream. That's what Cruz says. Of the fundamental orientation of black politics, which used to be Garvey-oriented, and it wasn't about Garvey. It was just about the movement of the people from the West Indies. At the same time, you know, where they built the Panama Canal. At the same time, black folk moved up from the plantations of the South. Right? And so that perfect storm of black migration provides the backdrop for all this radical thinking, all this radical development from left, center, and black orientations. And then the white liberals come with the integrationist orientation, and effectively they win the fight because we forgot about Garveyism when the Great Depression and World War II erased Garvey's importance to us. Garveyism was in L.A. Garveyism was in Oakland. Garveyism was in every city in the West Coast. Places like Omaha, Nebraska, called themselves Harlem of the West. I've been teaching in San Francisco for 22 years. San Francisco is called the Harlem of the West by San Franciscans. There's a book called The Black West. If you Google it, it's a green color book called The Black West. That book shows that every city and every little town in America during the 19-teens to the early 20s called itself Harlem of the West. If they were in Utah, it was Harlem of the West. They were black folk in Utah because the Mormons, and this is why we should condemn them to hell forever. The Mormons were the last ones. The Mormons were the ones that brought slavery as far as anybody. Nobody brought more slaves to the West Coast than the Mormons. The Mormons are, Utah is where slavery ends in America. Now think about that. Utah is the boundary of where slavery ends in America. The Mormons brought slavery to Utah. The hell with the Mormons and their racist teachings. And they've never owned up. And they have all our slave ancestors' records. When you're ready to get your reparations, contact the Mormons because they got your great, 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 great granddaddy's last name and his address and his master. The Mormons have it. The Mormons have all of our records because they keep these records based on their doctrines of baptism. So the best genealogist of black Americans is the Mormons. Why? Because they had our slave ancestors as far as they could take us west. So we should understand this.
I can say amen to that because I've been to Los Angeles. You have to go to the Mormons. They had all information about my family.
That's right. I had a pastor from San Francisco who was going to meet with some of them in a research lab, and he was trying to find a black woman who was the founding black woman of the Third Baptist Church in San Francisco, California, in the 1800s. Now, this is in 1850s. This is as random as a thing they could be looking for. Who is the founding woman of the Third Baptist Church in San Francisco? How would you think the Mormons would have that? But when Reverend Brown went to Utah, he was sitting in a library. He mentioned the woman's name. The woman in the secretary in the Mormon's tabernacle went downstairs, typed something in, came back with a whole folder on everything on the black woman that founded the church in San Francisco that the church did not have.
Yep, that's true.
So,
I have one more question.
Let me get back to your question about Cruz. Cruz and Adolph Reed Sr., you know, Adolph Reed Jr. is a political scientist like me, and I attacked him recently in an article you can look online called The Politics of the Black Power Movement. That's a research article I wrote that I really would recommend to the audience. It's called The Power of the Black Power Movement, The Politics of the Black Power Movement. But I talk about Adolph Reed Jr., but Adolph Reed Sr. and Harold Cruz allegedly had these fierce intellectual debates and differences. But Cruz was a historian. Cruz never got a PhD. Cruz was a World War II veteran. Cruz was self-taught. He was a failed artist and playwright. And he just got like kind of like Ta-Nehisi Coates. When Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote that article or that book called The World in Me, it just struck a chord based on what was going on. And Cruz tells us what was going on in the 40s and the 50s and how it related to the 60s and how the 60s didn't understand the 30s and 40s and 50s. That's what the crisis of the Negro intellectual is. We keep repeating the same mistakes because we don't understand the political, economic, and cultural stages of our history at a given time. So right now we're talking about Black Lives Matter. But what if this is the economic time? What if we shouldn't be talking about Black Lives Matter? What if we should only be talking about reparations? So reparations is the economic front. Is that where we are now? Because I'm on a reparations committee in San Francisco. I'm one of 15 people doing reparations in San Francisco. And then there's California State is doing it at the state level. And the governor is supporting it. And he might run for president soon. So we might finally have a white man other than Joe Biden and Bill Clinton who kept saying no, who will support reparations because Gavin Newsom is supporting reparations in the state of California. And I'm on the actual committee in the city of San Francisco. And we just delivered our recommendations to the city council last month. So we're not playing. But my question to us would be, how do we know which stage we're at? And that's what Cruz is asking. And the reason why we keep clashing and having backwards, our politics keep going backwards, is we keep misunderstanding when we should be doing what based on where we are regionally and what's going on, you know, within the larger milieu of black and American life, so that we can then try to figure out, is this an economic time? Is this a political time? Is this a cultural time? And it doesn't mean all three aren't present at all times. It means, but they're called fronts for a reason, which is the main thing. In Harlem, the Renaissance, there's all kinds of stuff going on beyond art and culture. But the main front was cultural. In the Reconstruction period, we're still dealing with trying to recover from slavery just two decades ago. But in that time period, that becomes where we see black elected officials. So that becomes the political front. Now, Booker comes and undermines that because he's not elected. So Booker undoes the first political front. Because Booker condemned the black Reconstruction leaders, and nobody knows this, but Columbia University in Harlem was racist as hell, and nobody knows this, but Columbia University in Harlem was racist as hell in trying to frame the black Reconstruction leaders of the 1860s to 1870s as incompetent buffoons, corrupt criminal, and all these other things. So Columbia University has never apologized to black people for disparaging us when we emerge in our political stage. But because we don't know this happened, we can't even challenge it. We can't even challenge Columbia University right now because most of us don't know Columbia helped undermine our political moment. So why don't you know about the political front? Because Booker Washington on the black front and Columbia University in Harlem on the academic front spent all their research focus on showing the incompetence of the Negro Reconstruction leaders. To hell with Columbia University. But that's who did it. And these kind of things happen in our history, throughout our history, from West Coast to East Coast, North to South. All these kind of evils have happened to us. And there's so many people who get away with that kind of evil, like John Hopkins with Henrietta Lacks, just get away with the evil they do to our people because they make sure we keep forgetting our cycles. So they're trying to do that right now. With, you know, pushing back on the 1619 Project, pushing back on critical race theory, right? They are now trying to confuse us. But with Martin Luther King, what moment was that? Was that an economic moment, a political moment, or a cultural moment? King didn't put no emphasis on economics. King did not have an economic agenda other than depriving white folk of our money for the buses for 1 year. And after that, he never fully developed an economic theory because he was really a socialist, but he couldn't admit it because that would, you know, lead to FBI and J. Edgar Hoover coming at him earlier. So King had to play down his left orientation, but King never really publicly, theoretically articulated an economic vision apart from reparations implied in his criticisms around the Marshall Plan when he advocated for a Marshall Plan and the GI Bill for black folk, a domestic one. So King was advocating for reparations. He never used that word, but absolutely, you'd be hard pressed. And we're looking at the anniversary of, we're observing Martin Luther King right this weekend, right? Be clear, Martin Luther King was a pro-reparations advocate. I'm sure by now the audience that would be interested in Time for an Awakening is also an audience that has seen many clips of Martin Luther King not talking about the dream, not talking about integration, but he's talking about I'm black and I'm beautiful. He talks about the land grants that all the white immigrants, like them Scotch-Irish I was talking about earlier, got from the federal government and all the county agents and how they got, you know, farms and how they got, you know, people to teach them how to mechanize the farm. And then King says, and these are the very people who tells a Negro to pick himself up by his own bootstraps. I know you've heard that.
Can I say that Dr. King went to Africa before Malcolm?
That's right. See, and I say that in my article on black the politics of the Black Power Movement. People don't know that about Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King went to Africa in 56 when Ghana got independent. The year after, in 57, the year after the bus boycott, the next thing King does is goes to Africa in Ghana, and he's walking with Kwame Nkrumah, Du Bois, Ralph Bunche, Shirley Graham, Du Bois, who was a radical in her own right, and his wife. And King and Coretta Scott got sick the next day. So they saw Kwame Nkrumah come into his power. They saw this veneration, and then they got food poisoning and came back home. But
yeah, malaria, food poisoning or something, right? Yeah, I got you.
It might have been, you know what? They did it to Malcolm, didn't they? They might have done it to King. Sir. But my point is, at that point, I'm just going to get this out real quick. King was inspired by Ghana's independence. And most people, like the Black Power students, when they come along criticizing King, they are like, King is not a radical. Like, they all Africa conscious because they got dashikis, they got afros. And yet Martin Luther King was there at the very moment of African independence, standing side by side with Kwame Nkrumah.
All right. I guess you're running out of time, but I have one more question. What was Cruz's position on the national question? Was he for a black nation, for like a Republic New Africa situation?
He would support different projects, but he felt like we should all decide that. He felt like that's what the party would do. See, the problem with us misunderstanding what a party should be is because we're being confused by the two parties. A party is supposed to be an umbrella for all of our policy issues and positions. And then we fight it out among ourselves, and then we unite as a party. And that was Cruz's point. If we have not gotten our LGBTQ politics in a black party, our black liberal politics in a black party, our labor politics in a black party, our women's and gender politics in a black party, our youth politics in a black party, our health politics in a black party, our issues about international affairs and, you know, Palestine, Israel, or China in Africa, we should have all of these debates as a black group every 4 years in a black party platform. And at the end of 4 years, we come out united like the Democrats and Republicans, even though we know that's not consistent, but that's the idea. But what we think is a black party is a revolution, just like we think reparations is a revolution. Well, that's the police talking to you. When you look at Callie House, the mother of reparations in Tennessee in the 1870s, and Reverend Isaiah Washington, the father of reparations, they joined, they weren't the leaders of the movement, they joined the Black Tennessee reparations movement. They sued the government for $56 million and the U.S. Treasury. The U.S. government threw Callie House in prison. There's a book on her written by Mary Frances Berry called My Skin is Black or Dark is True. And they document how Callie House in Tennessee was not the inspiration. It was the black people in the neighborhoods of Tennessee who were already in the tens of thousands. She had 400,000 followers. Callie House had 400,000 followers in the black reparations movement. This is the problem. We thought integration was our first politics. See, this is how the devil confused us. Callie House was the economic front. There it is again. She sued. Look at this. Let me tell you this before I get back to what the white folk do with it. When she sued, the American government saw it as a radical idea. In the same way people misread parties, black parties are conservative things. It's conservative by its very nature as a mainstream institution in which you're trying to cooperate in. You ain't breaking no laws. You ain't got no guns. You ain't kidnapping no people. You're trying to vote. That's conservative. That ain't revolution. And neither is reparations. But the American government, because of racism, tries to make a black party sound like a threat. And you got two white parties. But they try to make a brown or red or black or multi, like, because our politics has always been rainbow politics. The politics that come out of Hal Washington is rainbow politics. The politics that come out of Fred. Where the hell we get the name from? The Rainbow Coalition come from Fred Hampton in Chicago, and then Jesse Jackson steals it. And I didn't even know for many years that Jesse stole it from Fred Hampton. I had no idea. I didn't know Jesse stole Rainbow Coalition from Fred Hampton. I promise you, until about 2 years ago, and I'm ashamed of that. I just did not know. But my point is, Jesse, when black folks start doing these independent party conventions, they met in Gary, Indiana in 72, the National Legal, the Gary Convention. Right, we were trying to do independence. And we did this in Philly. We did it in Little Rock, Arkansas. Willie Brown met with Diggs, with Depp, with Ron Dellums, with Barbara Lee, with all the leading blacks, Willie Brown out here in San Francisco. They all met. And when they were going to, and Farrakhan was there. Farrakhan was at the Gary Convention. Amiri Baraka was the main guy. Amiri Baraka acted such a damn fool that they had all the black Democrats left because they had white constituents. People like Stokes up in Cleveland and Gibson in Newark, New Jersey, and some of the early Stokes. Black mayors like Gary, Indiana, where it was hosted. So there's this new so immediately in the 60s, because we don't understand what had happened in the previous stages and how these white folk kind of distracted us by confusing our eras, when Callie House is out front, that's a new economic stage. That's 1870s. That's the economic stage right before Booker emerges, and the emphasis is reparations. And then they put her in, listen to this, they put Callie House in prison. And they use a charge of mail fraud on Callie House. They wait 20 years and nobody knows it. And use the same mail fraud
charges against Marcus Garvey to deport him. Let me say that again. They used it against Callie House first and Isaiah Washington. The book, again, is Mary Frances Berry's My Skin is Dark is True. I hope Elliot can find it and put it in the comments so you can see it. That book documents this history, how reparations was the first black politics after abolition. Our first politics, back to Africa. Our second politics, abolition of slavery. Our third politics, reparations. The first politics the white people tricked us with by putting our political in the place of our economic. When Callie House is talking reparations and Booker Washington is saying we should have our separate economic development, the white man comes along with his politics and says, no, Negro, you should be engaged in politics, civil rights. Meanwhile, Callie House and Booker Washington, who between the two of them had probably 5 million black people following them, the two of them. And this is when, what's her name? Ida B. Wells is up in Chicago. She's following Booker. She's an admirer of Booker Washington. Everybody's an admirer of Booker Washington. Garvey comes to America to study under Booker Washington. Du Bois was under Booker Washington. But Booker's philosophy was, black folk don't need white folk to be strong in America. We just need each other. And when he abandoned the politics, a lot of black folk that felt like we should do politics were mad. But guess who told us to do politics when it was the economic time? Callie and Booker tell us it's the economics between 1870 with Callie up into 1895 with Booker. 25 years of economic emphasis, black development, black economic development, reparations between her and him. And the white folk come along in the white NAACP and say, nigga, focus on politics. And they use Du Bois and the talented 10th and those integrationist Negroes. And they change the conversation and have us talking about elections and voting when we were already 50 years deep into our economic front. And they completely confused it. So then we come out of it. We don't know what stage we're at. So they got us running around talking about integration with the white folk in 1909, and they didn't even let us in until about 1980. Now think about how wicked that had to be. 1909, you realistically shipwrecking our politics and changing our focus from economic development that could have given us an economic floor at the appropriate economic moment. And here's what you do. You say, nope. Y'all gotta stop that here. Take these politics. Now go ask the white man for the vote. Those are the games they've been playing with us, which is what one of your speakers said in your commercial lead when they talk about how they're masters at playing these games. We were going along under Booker, the NAACP comes along. And they try to be his friend at first. Then they set up in Harlem and oppose him. And then when Garvey got up in Harlem, Garvey came to meet Booker, but Booker died the year before. So when Garvey goes up into the NAACP headquarters in Harlem, he walks in there and sees nothing but white people. And that's the sad thing. You can Google Walter White. For the first 50 years of the NAACP, its leadership was all white. The first Negro is Walter White, and Walter White is whiter than Ben Jealous. Walter White and Ben Jealous, Google him. Walter White was so white, that man used to go to lynchings. And he got rid of Du Bois because Du Bois called for racial separation. And he hated Du Bois. But he was as white as, what's this boy name that's on the Black Lives Matter group on Facebook? Sean King. He was white as Sean King. You see how he's late? I'm not into colorism, but I want you to see certain patterns as it relates to these people as they emerge. Because a lot of times these black folk who are mixed heritage or so-called mulatto, a word we don't use much anymore, a lot of them have racial jealousy of their white relatives because they felt like they didn't get the full use of the white property that's in them because the brown is too much for them to cash in on it. And that's what happened to Homer Plessy in Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. Look it up. He sued for the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause because he said to not give him the property of being white, it would be denying him of equal protection. So Homer Plessy was so light-skinned, he was trying to sue to be white. But he the one that gave us Jim Crow.
Brother Norman.
All right, thank you, Larry. Let me get off this phone. Let someone else call. I know there are other people.
If you read my book on black nationalism, I'm not trying to pitch my book, but if you look at my book on black nationalism, when people looked at my book, they, the reviewers, they all three
who were referees that I don't even know who they were. They all mentioned the overlaps between it and Howard, the work of Howard Cruz. And that's good and bad because Cruz has a whole lot of enemies. And if you like Cruz and if you like black nationalism, or you write about Cruz or you write about black nationalism, the white academy don't mess with people like me. I mean, I'm at a white school, but they don't mess with me. I'm not popular. You know, I'm thankful to Carl Nelson, Elliot Booker, a brother back in Brooklyn who does a TV show called Black Men Screaming, Maurice Carver in Brooklyn. I got here in San Francisco, KPOO. Right now, all the white folk have taken me off TV in San Francisco. I've been on San Francisco TV since 2007 when Obama ran. Recently, a white woman cursed me out, threatened me. A Latino woman cursed me out, threatened me. I cussed him back out. And then all these white folk, just like with Kanye, all of a sudden, all of everybody stopped calling, except people like Elliot, Carl Nelson, and black folk. And that's why anytime y'all call, I don't give a damn if the white people, I swear to you, never ask me to do another interview. My heart will be broken if you don't.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you, sir.
Let's go to 267.
Yes, Brother Elliot.
Yes, sir.
And Brother Richard. And Dr. Taylor, one of my favorite professors. And I'm going to say this to you, sir. If they talk about Du Bois's pen with like a sword, and Malcolm and Farrakhan's voices would you know, shake the hell out of hell, man, your voice, man, your stuff is so talented. I never seen your writing, but I hear your voice. Man, I look, hear everything that you say and do, especially when I went to California. You guided me all through that. But, man, you went all the way back to French Hall and Trotter, man. I mean, you went all the way to Boston. People don't know the history of Boston. And, you know, people always talk about going to Martha's Vineyard. I said, black people need to go to Boston to understand what black people did in Boston.
Sure.
Martha's Vineyard. So, you know, every time you come on here, man, you just... just open it up, right, to where it should be at.
Right.
You know what I mean? And on a national level, I met you through Elliot, which is on our level, which is the grassroots level, which is really national. But man, a lot of people need to hear your voice. A lot of people need to hear Elliot and Richard all over the world. But man, this is really great.
You know, I went to school in King of Prussia in Philadelphia too. So outside of Philadelphia,
I know. Tell me about the Philadelphia history. And you know, everywhere you go, you open up things. You open up things. You open up things. And you always talk about Howard Cruz.
One time I snuck over back to Jay's house and tried to get him to give us some money for our black group.
I hear you, brother. So, man, I wrote as much because I'm traveling. I'm driving. I'm in supermarkets. I'm a lot of places. And I'm trying to write down everything you say so I can go and rediscover what you just wrote.
Do me a favor and get that article I wrote last year. I think it was May last year. It's called Politics of the Black Power Movement. And if you read that, you'll hear my voice. And it's not a long read.
Love it, man. I'll be listening. Yeah. I'm listening.
Thank you, brother. And yes, Elliot, there's a whole argument that we're not talking on that. There are other people at the local level, like Maria, Callie House, that go back to our conversation of the Negro Wampus. People like Robert Church Sr., there was a man in Memphis. He was a black Republican leader. There's a book on him called A Black Republican Leader in the Age of Democratic Ascendancy. And there was these three stages. It was like, were black people who broke away from the Party of Lincoln sellouts like we would see a modern Republican? Or were they independents? Or did they join? You know, there's three different stages, and it's all still the political front a sub conversation in it in terms of politics we're talking about. You know, when black folk like these the ones that were angry with the Republicans for not supporting the black policies of the 13th through 15th Amendments, were they seen as sellouts by modern blacks for breaking from the party the way we see people like Kanye or Ye and some of these black MAGAs, Candace Owens? Because we got to be careful. Because if they were righteous as black and tans from breaking from the Republicans, you might be careful. You might be supporting black MAGA now saying these two things are similar. Or, so what I'm saying is, I'm offering three possibilities. Is it a sellout? Is it independence? Or is it partisanship? So if it's a sellout, it's that we're breaking away from our, you know, party, and we're going to act like black-faced Negroes saying white things to white people about black people to get money. And that's the sellout. So what I'm saying to you is there was a time when we were all Republicans. And then this is the beginning of us breaking away right here. So in these periods between the Negro Wumpins and the black and tans, I'm asking the audience, do you see them as sellouts? Were they forward thinking? Were they independent thinkers? And did that mean that it leads to, like Kanye, you putting on MAGA and the Confederate outfit? Because that's where you end up becoming, in my opinion, sickly partisan. But if he's not a sellout, but what if he's just breaking away? So if we're looking at these early thinkers like T.H. Fortin and the father of William Monroe Trotter and Ben Trotter and his generation, then we got to ask ourselves, are they independents or are they just trying to break over to the other party? Because there's three stages. You can stay in the party, the Democrat, the party that blacks are in. At one time it was the Republicans, now it's the Democrats. Or you could go independent like our people did. Or you can be crazy and go over to the other side, like I said earlier, about realignment. And what I'm suggesting to us is there's a lot of black individuals who are like the Negro Wump, who were local, not well-known, and not famous people. It's like Callie House, but she wasn't one. But I'm just giving you an example that there were people on who were doing for black, you know, Republicans who were upset with the party's racism, and then the 1876 betrayal that happens in the 1876 Hayes-Tilden presidential contest, the Republican Party of Lincoln gives the white South control over the Negro again. So it was a betrayal. So that's what the black and tans and the Negro want to do, is make sure we don't end up in that situation again. And that's what I feel like was happening to us right now.
Well,
the way,
you know,
the Democrats were responding to Trump, out of y'all on Nancy, Biden, y'all are kind of too. Y'all letting this stuff go on. January 6th, ain't nobody going to jail for real, and here we are in the midst of a post Reconstruction type backlash all again.
Well, you know how I see that, Dr. Taylor, and I want Richard to kind of weigh in on this too. That the difference is the Negro conventions of that time, and even after the Negro conventions kind of waned, and you had the period that we're talking about, our ancestors that were involved in a political struggle, whether they be the Democrats at that time or the Republicans or even the Negro Wumps and some of the other independent formations, they would meet. When they called meetings, these men would talk. They expressed the way they felt and why. And The Guardian and other black publications would put the information out there so the people could see it.
But we don't do the 1858 Chatham, Ontario, Ohio, Canada convention. The whole debate was John Brown's plan to overthrow Harper's Ferry. Listen, who was there? Martin Delaney was there. Mary Shad Carey, who was a black nationalist who separated and moved to Canada and was the woman where people went to go when they wanted to leave America, they would go stay with her up in Canada. H. Douglas Ford. It was Martin Delaney. It was Henry Highland Garnett. It was everybody but Frederick Douglass made it. And John Brown was there in 1858 debating, and he was the only white man in the room. And the question was on the floor, should we support the John Brown uprising? And then when the NAACP is created in 1909, it's on the 50th anniversary of the 1909, 50 years later, anniversary of John Brown's October 16th, 1859 uprising. So there's a lot of history, a lot of local reaction. But I want to clarify this, that other than John Brown, you know, these white liberals in the NAACP, they misdirect our movement. They misdirect us into integration without asking us how we felt as a people. And they talk, you know, they talk only to black elites about this. And these are the black folks in their inner circles who inspired these folk. And they began to fund the black colleges like Harvard and Booker T. Washington School at Tuskegee. They were already funding Hampton Institute. You know, but the next generation of black folk emerge. It's like James Weldon Johnson, the brother who wrote who's a member of the NAACP and also wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing. At the turn of the 19 teens, there's this whole thing where black people are trying to figure out how they should relate to Eugene V. Debs, Woodrow Wilson, and Teddy Roosevelt, and all of these alternatives, these big giant men of history running up against each other. And black folk were in the populist movement. We were in the progressive movement, and we were trying to figure out our way in terms of, you know, and so this era, you know, 19-teens, early 1920s, that's called progressivism with a capital P in American political history, like the era of progressive presidents. And that would include like Woodrow Wilson. But Woodrow Wilson is the Donald Trump of his time. And we should understand that black migration is happening on Wilson's watch. And we should understand that when black people moved to Washington, D.C., those that weren't already there, Woodrow Wilson, who was the president of Princeton University and the president of the organization I belong to, that all political science belong to, the main one called the American Political Science Association, APSA. That's the main one. The black one is called the National Conference of Black Political Scientists. I was president of that. But Woodrow Wilson was president of the white one as a political scientist. So that's what he did. Woodrow Wilson was born in Virginia. Woodrow Wilson went to school with Thomas H. Dixon. Woodrow Wilson was team roommates with the man who wrote The Leopard Spots and The Klansman that we talked about earlier that became the basis of the film Birth of a Nation. So we always talk about the devil W.D. Griffith, but John Hope Franklin, I was at an event one time with him before he died, and John Hope Franklin insisted it was T.H. Dixon who was the devil that W.D. Griffith made his film on, but it was his writing about us as this monstrous disease on the white society where the spots on the leopard, that's why Du Bois wrote Souls of Black Folk, that in the fight with Booker Washington and Trotter is why he put that chapter in there. But the reason why he wrote the book, as I mentioned earlier, Anna Julia Cooper told him in D.C., you got to answer this racist thing because our people are being lynched. This is 1903 after the lynchings are happening. And they were saying we have to be killed off. We have to be genocided. So Du Bois says it's the souls of black folk that is more powerful than anything you white people have ever come up with. And that's what black people still don't understand. That first book was the best black book ever written in history, in my opinion. Nobody's ever written a better book than Du Bois in The Souls of Black Folk. I don't care what book you throw up to me, not no autobiography of Malcolm X that we now know was full of untruths. I'm telling you, you can't tell me nothing comes close to the to The Souls of Black Folk in black history. They ain't a number two book.
But you know, you know what, Professor Taylor? One thing that I do see, and looking for the feedback, and we can go to the callers, but I do see as you're laying out those cycles, there's also becoming a split in the leadership.
Yes.
The split in the leadership is, and I would argue with, is that those who are representing those who are being moved from the South and the South. Because as you said with Callie House, those people of the South who were not, their leadership came out of their natural social order. That wasn't all necessarily educated people. They were the ones who made themselves church leaders. They were the carpenters. They were the leaders who were organizing that supported Callie House. And as they moved north, that North Carter, then those mixed race that I'm arguing who had education to some degree, some split with Booker T, some split with Trotter, but they were, you see the split with Trotter. Trotter was representing specifically those who now came and they want to, what, emulate black elites, not to a degree, but they weren't necessarily incorporated into the white structure.
Mm-hmm.
There were, and Trotter was organizing them. This is the way I'm interpreting. Trotter was organizing and saying that was the basis of the Negro Womp, right? We, Booker, you may, the skilled, the the not the intelligentsia, but the entrepreneurial, the skilled craft, the land on labor, the black land labor. You're organizing them, and whites are supporting that, but black people, you're disenfranchising them. So I'm saying that there's two leaderships. So by the 1920s, you see that split even more. By the 1940s, you see that split even more in relationship to these two leaderships.
Yes.
Because what modern them are organizing that movement, Niagara movement, is specifically what at that point was for the race. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even for the political party. It was for the race. But they were saying, look, the parties, Republicans or Democrats, are not serving us.
Right.
So
especially when they make a turn to the imperialism, right, and begin right. with the Berlin Conference
right.
and the up and the rape of Africa, when America begins its imperialism. This is also with Woodrow Wilson. This is the 14-point plan. This is World War One. This is the time that the end war, you know, to end, was it the war for democracy, the war to end all wars, and they had another war within 20 years for within one generation. This is the key point. But see, to me, the focus here in the 19-teens is Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson becomes like Donald Trump, the main focus of black politics. And there's great, even though there's a great deal of diversity, like you say, you know, when the 20th century emerges, there's all kind of, you know, intellectual orientations, Asa Philip Randolph and the labor organization, right? You had the NAACP and advocacy. You still had Du Bois' organization, the National Legal Labor Bureau, I mean, National Legal Business League, rather, under Booker Washington's disciples. But the key, like James Weldon Johnson, you know, he's an integrationist from NAACP. He writes in 1916, The Unavoidable Issue. Another article is written, Vote to Defeat Woodrow Wilson. See, Trotter is still important here. Trotter, if you go into that book I mentioned earlier, Trotter goes to Washington, D.C. twice and curses Woodrow Wilson out to his face twice. And Woodrow Wilson said to Trotter, no American. I almost thought about writing a book one day about Trotter and calling it No American, because what Woodrow Wilson said to him after Trotter literally cussed him out, Woodrow Wilson, and he went there twice and cussed him out twice with other black leaders, and they didn't let Booker Washington or Du Bois come, but Trotter was there, and Trotter cussed Woodrow Wilson out so bad that Woodrow Wilson said, no American has ever talked to me the way you have. That's what Woodrow Wilson said to William Monroe Trotter. Look at it, Google it, see if Trotter didn't curse out Woodrow Wilson twice. It's in my book. It's in my dissertation. Where what happens is, what black folk were doing, this kind of goes back to my question of, is this sellout? Is this a sellout or is it independence? When we break from our party and want to become, something else. But is that something else neutral? Like I asked for in my dissertation, or are we moving over to marry the other party? Those are three different things. Are we going to stay by ourselves, and are we going to stay, you know, or are we going to join somebody else, or are we going to sell out within? And what you see happening is the black position moves increasingly from being pro-Republican to anti-Woodrow Wilson, and Woodrow Wilson's a Democrat. So black folks don't come into the Democratic Party until FDR. And even then, we do it slowly over 30 years between 32 and 64. We don't do it all at once. We do it over three decades. And so we do it until 64. That's when we finally break from our 100-year relationship with the Republicans. And if you do the math right now, 108 years or so as Republicans, compare that with blacks have been Democrats for 58 years. Blacks have been Democrats for 58 years. Blacks were Republicans for 100 and like about 105 years. So it's still going to take us 50 years from now into 2075 for us to have finally been Democrats as long as we have been Republicans. And no other group in America, black or white, male or female, gay or straight, Native American, anything, has had any kind of politics like black people. We are so unique in our politics in that way. We broke up with our party and chased the devil out the one that was hanging us. Show me another example of that. Show me another group who took over a party that was killing them. The Democrats were killing us, literally. And then the Republic in 1964 with Barry Goldwater, everything changed. But it goes back to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a racist. Woodrow Wilson celebrated Birth of a Nation with his classmate T.H. Dixon. Woodrow Wilson invited all of Congress, all of the Supreme Court, and they sat and watched this film. And then Woodrow Wilson came out laughing and smiling to America and said, "This is like history with lightning." And it was celebrating lynching and the redemption of the South against the Negro. We cannot send the Belgian Congo emperor
Leopold
to hell enough, and we can't send these people to hell enough for the betrayal of black people politics. Woodrow Wilson, black people should have hell reserved for certain people. And Woodrow Wilson is one of the people we should always say is in our hell, not God's hell, but in black hell. Woodrow Wilson is in black hell. Ronald Reagan is in black hell. And there's a few Negroes that are in black hell too for selling our people out. But I want to be clear that the main focus of black politics shifts to Woodrow Wilson and his racism, because again, between Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s and Woodrow Wilson in the 1910s, the federal buildings were integrated. So a black person could use any bathroom they wanted. Woodrow Wilson is the first president across 60 years after Lincoln to go out of his way to segregate the federal buildings in America, in D.C. So when we migrate north, he segregates the buildings. He kicks us out of all of the buildings we were working in. So when you see that movie Hidden Figures and Taraji P. Henson's character has to run a mile to the bathroom, that was 50 years after Woodrow Wilson had decided black people cannot use the bathrooms of the federal government except in certain reserved areas. Woodrow Wilson was a devil who segregated the federal government against black people. And the Hidden Figures just gave you the tail end of it by showing you that by that time in the 1950s, sisters were still having to run a mile and a half to go to the bathroom, when before Wilson, every racist president before him didn't take his time to separate the federal building. And so I think we should understand that even black Democrats who were pro-Wilson, colored Democrats, they would be the sellouts. They would be the Kanyes. I think Kanye West is a sellout when it comes to this. We might think he's smart on some things and he says some necessary things about the way these people have been owning our culture. Hell yeah. We all need to call it out. That's what Cruz was calling out. You know why they call Howard Cruz an anti-Semite? Because he has a whole chapter saying what Kanye West said in the Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Look it up. A whole chapter. And if you Google Howard Cruz anti-Semite, you're going to see all these angry people talking about how Cruz was an anti-Semite, when all Cruz does is criticize one Jewish person who won't respect our culture. And he talks about the Communist Party, USA, and how they tried to run the black movement through remote control, through these white, faces of the Communist Party, USA. But Eugene V. Debs said this. Right around this time, when Wilson is on the scene, Eugene V. Debs says the Socialist Party of America is colorblind. He says we have nothing. That's what he says. We have nothing special for the Negro. That's what Woodrow Wilson said. I mean, Eugene V. Debs. So Eugene V. Debs says we ain't got nothing special for the Negro. That's the socialist, y'all. We ain't got nothing. Just like Carla says that to us later, right? I ain't doing nothing for y'all. Well, that's what Eugene V. Debs said first. He said nothing. Nothing special for the Negro. It's all about labor. The only color we see is labor, which, again, that color blindness don't help the black man who was not allowed to join labor. And that's why Asa Philip Randolph comes after Eugene V. Debs, because Debs was so right. Why we didn't need a great labor leader like C.L. Dellums in Oakland or Asa Philip Randolph in Harlem when they created the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And that whole story of this group, what is that, man? That movie's called A Thousand Men Named George.
Yeah, 10,000 black men named George.
Yes, that's based here in Oakland and Harlem. That's Oakland and Harlem working together, Oakland and Harlem. C.L. Dellums is the uncle of Ron Dellums, who was the mentor of Barbara Lee. So this tradition is still alive in black politics right now. And Barbara Lee just announced in California 3 days ago she's running for Senate. Do you understand Barbara Lee is an extension of the Black Panther Party still, just like Chaka Khan is? Our politics ain't dead. They just got us confused as to what stages we're in. We just got to clarify it ourselves. And this is hard, Elliot, because we got so many voices. And like Brother Richard said, so many opinions, so many fronts. But we need to understand that black people united against Woodrow Wilson. because this is the period of lynching. This is Teddy Roosevelt dogging our people in Houston. If you look at, there's another movie on Netflix about the Houston riot when, I think it's called the 369 or 386, where the black, where there was a bunch of lynching going on in Houston, and the black folk came up and killed a bunch of white folk in Houston. And you know, and that was going on in Memphis. And let me get back on this real quick. What happened in Houston happened in Memphis in 1865. As soon as we got out of the Civil War, black soldiers were walking around in Memphis, Tennessee, drinking and partying for being free. They had no guns. They were decommissioned. And the Irish police of Memphis have a massacre against the black soldiers of Memphis. This is in a number of books I could point to. And it's called Massacre. I think it's called Massacre at Memphis. But it documents, and here's my main point. It documents how the first conflict between free black people and the police was in Memphis when those black soldiers got free and were walking around celebrating, and they were drunk, and the Irish police, because you know they drink, the Irish police, they were drunk. And so the black soldiers and the Irish young men, just like they did in the, well, I'll leave that alone, but they end up getting into this big fight. It becomes a race riot. And so the first race riot against black people is from the police after the Civil War. The police. So what I'm trying to help you understand, this is why I said I'm doing a background research right now for a second book, another book on fighting the Irish, is that book on Memphis, the Memphis police riot against the black soldiers, the same thing happened in Houston in that film on Netflix. And in Memphis, when the police finished rioting, they killed everything black they could. And the book on, that documents this history says this is the seed of the relationship between black America and law enforcement. Is the massacre of Memphis, the same place that kills King less than 60 years later, the massacre at Memphis is the first massacre that happens where the police do the work instead of the riots. And I just got finished teaching the class this past semester. And I tried to help my students understand that modern policing was founded in Irish culture in Boston. In New York, the second police department, Boston the first, New York's the second. Those are Irish police departments. The third is San Francisco, California. I got four contracts with them right now. I work for San Francisco Police Department. I ain't no snitch, but I do community advocacy on behalf of black people. Like, if you look right now, Google, 3 days ago, this is the work I'm doing, Elliot. I ain't just sitting here running my mouth. I'm on the reparations committee in San Francisco. Check, Google it, and see if you don't see 3 days ago in San Francisco, the police commission just signed orders telling SFPD they had to stopping black people arbitrarily, and I and a bunch of other people, mainly black folk from the neighborhood, not a bunch of bourgeoisie Negroes, sat with SFPD's black chief, and we told them, we need you to stop pulling us over for tags, you know, lights, dice, and just pretextual random arbitrary things, and see, and Google it and see if it hasn't passed. It did. So that's the kind of stuff I'm doing. I'm helping, trying to minimize contact between our people and the police. So that what I'm trying to get at, though, is what we don't know as a people, like we don't know those three fronts, those cycles. We don't know that there's a book called The White When Whites Riot. It's a little book, When Whites Riot. And what I'm trying to get us to appreciate is that white policing, racist policing, is an extension of the old white riot and pogrom, P-O-G-R-O-M. Pogrom means, like, you know, massacres. And these massacres they carried out on our people become the original relationship. Listen to me. The original relationship between police and black folk is in massacres. How the hell are we ever going to be okay? How the hell we can ever make peace with the police when we began in Memphis with a massacre? And at the behind the badge was this whole, what I'm trying to say, Elliot, I'm taking too long to say it, behind that badge was Irish resentment for the Negro. And we got to get behind the badge, the Irish resentment, because the Irish betrayed us. The Irish never had slaves in Europe. They were dogged and, servants over there. They weren't no slaves. But they didn't enslave us in Africa. I mean, in Europe or from Europe. They came all the way to live down south, and then they became our masters because they were too damn poor under the British to own us. So when did the Irish become racist? The Irish were oppressed themselves. You can read a book called The Black Radical Tradition out of Santa Barbara. And you'll see that it outlines the ways in which the Irish history becomes the precursor to black slavery and imperialism and colonialism. In other words, what they did to the Irish in one way, they tested it on them and they perfected it on our people. And so the Irish are not responsible for slavery from Europe. They are responsible for slavery down south. And when the British stop enslaving us and turn their interest to other things, it's those poor white people like the Irish and the Jews and the Poles and the Welsh and these other low-life white, these low-order white people who become the most racist. So what I'm saying is, if the Anglos of the 17th century were the founders of slavery, enslaving black people, I'm saying the Irish of the 19th century around the Reconstruction period and the lynching period, that's who's doing that to us. Not that British. See, the British enslaved us. The Irish are the ones that came up with the lynch rope and the Klan, and they've never dealt with it. And that turned into the police badge. And I'm not paranoid. My degrees are on the wall. I ain't no ignorant fool. And you can dismiss my degrees if you want to. God damn it, you don't know where I came from. You are not allowed to dismiss my education. I worked too hard and came from nothing with nobody's support. No money, no father. Nobody. So please show me the respect that I came from the bottom and earned my education. And these damn books is what educated me, not the place I got my degree from. So I am mostly self-taught, even though I'm educated. And you should be too. Self-taught. Because you can't get this knowledge here that we have unless you have done your own independent study. How do I know all this stuff? Because I read all day, every book I can get my hand on. I'm trying to absorb information to put to the use of my people. And I'm telling you, the Irish and the problem black folk got with the police is the problem black folk got with the Irish. Let me say this. If you go back further in history real quickly to a man named Charles Remond, Charles Remond, you'll see he was working with Garrison up in Boston in the 1830s. Until Frederick Douglass showed up, he was the most well-known black man in America, but he had never been a slave. When Frederick Douglass showed up, it was like a 300 compared to the Bentley. Everybody said the 300 looked like a Bentley till the Bentley show up. Well, everybody thought Charles Remond looked like a Negro leader under Garrison until a real 6'4". Broad chest black man from Maryland named Frederick Douglass, one of the greatest black men and the most photographed human being of the 19th century, to offset the stigma of us that they began to use in blackface and disfiguring us. And I just learned this recently, that Frederick Douglass was the most photographed black man in the 19th century intentionally, so you could see his beautiful presence juxtaposed to all the Sambos and Zip Coons and other Negro figures. But it's important, I think, for us to just understand that we've had these very powerful moments, that our politics have always been nimble. We've had people like George Edwin Taylor ran for president, but he did it as an independent. We had people, a guy named Rufus Perry, who's in this book on Hubert Henry Harrison, who was a lawyer and he married a Jewish woman. And he supported Harrison and Harrison's paper called The Voice. You had a man named John E. Bruce, who saw slavery end in 1856. He was born the same year as Booker Washington. John Bruce, and this is in the Schomburg collection up in Harlem. He saw everything from slavery to integration happen. And he joined Garvey in the UNIA. So what I'm trying to tell you is there were many, many people who will never ever know who were a part of these efforts to put forth an understanding of our people. But if we're going to understand why the police in Black America can't understand each other, you got to go back to the fact that the slave patrols, when people talk about them, they got to be careful. The slave patrols were federal. 1789, 1850,
about 180 years apart, they had two different fugitive slave clauses, one with the original Constitution, and they made it twice as strong in 1850. And this is what sets John Brown off. This is what sets off Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman. It's like the fugitive slave law is basically time for revolution. And so there's this black awakening. You know, there's a time for an awakening when the fugitive slave clause came about. And that's when black America got woke, as these white people try to, you know, steal our word from us nowadays. They became aware and they fought back. That becomes the basis of their struggle. And we do it on every kind of front. And we have leadership splits because we have so many different approaches and fronts and interests. But it ultimately comes down to the reality that when you look at our strategies and our struggles, we've always had a leadership, but we've had diversity in leadership. And never have we had a united black leadership. And I don't think it's realistic because, you know, we're in a colonial condition and we keep trying to solve our black problem through overcoming racism. The problem is we actually are a colonial group that was colonized, like the Jamaicans are colonizing Jamaica, like the Brazilians are colonizing Brazil, like the Dominicans are colonizing Dominica, the Puerto Ricans and the Haitians are all colonized blacks. They're not from here. We ain't from here. But we done got so, you know, absorbed into this system that we don't even recognize. We keep trying to solve our black racial condition when it's actually a colonial problem. We're a colonized.
Richard.
We solve our problem because we don't know how to solve. How do we legally solve our colonizing problem? Because that's what the American Revolution was supposed to do. The American Revolution was supposed to get us free, but it didn't. So now we have a colony problem because now we're the slaves and we're still behind with the other colony that was colonized by Britain. So Britain colonized the Africans and the whites, and now we're both behind, and now we end up with them. That's tragic. But again, there's always been this violent resentment from the South, mainly at the Scotch-Irish, and I'm suggesting to us it's part of the problem we have with policing. Our problem with policing is the problem with the Irish. If you go back to Minstrel and go back to the Alabama Scottsboro boys cases, look on what was they doing on that train. Black boys and Irish boys from Louisiana were going to Alabama to work, and as they normally did, and when they got drunk, they celebrated and laughed and partied together. And that's where Minstrel came, until the white folks start blacking up. And then they start blackening up. But who was the ones blackening up? It was the Irish and the Jews. It wasn't everybody. It was the Irish and the Jews, the low whites. And they niggered up. They blacked up and tried to end up this interaction. But the interaction between the Irish workers and black workers, males, was around water in New York. Like, Minstrel came from off-Broadway in New York. It's not from Alabama. Minstrel's not from the South. Minstrel was like Broadway performance. And it was the Irish, and there's plenty of books on this that document the cultural interaction between the Irish and blacks in the formation of minstrel, and it really came out of the white jealousy of our black bodies moving in ways that they could never move because we were not Christian, and they were. And their world is linear, and our world is not linear. Our world is cyclical. Our world is spinning. Our world is, we do the ring shout. We do everything with vibe and energy and balance and we, Lord knows, we know we got more rhythm, so I ain't got to make that point. And so I think we have to recognize, that part of our problem, of our unresolved problem with the police, like all these other areas that we don't have good knowledge of about their orders and relationships, is we don't understand as a black people that the Irish had their own insecurities, and then when they found their ability to own black people for the first time in ways they never did when they were over in Europe, but when they came to Alabama, Georgia, Virginia, Maryland, Tennessee, Texas, Louisiana, all of that right there, all the white South is not British. The white South is Irish, Scotch, and that's Protestant, not Catholic. The Catholic ones are up there in New England.
And that was the big difference. But down south, they Protestants, and they usually in the Presbyterian church. And that's, you know, that's been the main enemy of black people. But the policing problem that we have comes out of this Irish black animosity, because again, Charles Remond went back to Dublin, Ireland. When he showed up, I was making a joke about the 300 in Chrysler, the 300 in the Bentley. Well, when before Douglas shows up in Boston as a free, as an escaped fugitive, all black people were fugitives by the fugitive slave laws. That's where the original policing issue comes from. But real quickly, Charles Remond, before Frederick Douglass becomes famous, goes to Dublin. Remond, R-E-M-O-N-D. Look this black man up. This man went to Dublin on behalf of black people and talked to their founding father, Danny O'Connell, the one that created that song. You know when the police get shot in New York, or New York Undercover, or CSI, when the cop gets shot, they say, oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling, right? Y'all have heard that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know you have. So that song is sung whenever a cop is killed or dies. Even regardless of the race, it's just an Irish cop thing, especially in Boston and New York. They do it with the bagpipes. Danny Boy, Danny Boy was Danny O'Connell. He was their George Washington of Ireland. Charles Remond and black people went to Ireland and asked him to take a pro-black American abolition position on the slavery question, and Danny O'Connell said yes. So Danny O'Connell supports abolition, and the Irish of America say we cannot do that because we have to be loyal to the red, white, and blue and to trying to become white, because the Irish hadn't become white yet. That's the name of the book. The book that I'm talking about, it even has on the front cover of it the black and white dancing together. Google the book called How the Irish Became White and see if you'll see some Irishmen inside dancing. And the separation is with the black boy outside, but they still working together. They still playing. The black boy playing the drums, the white boy's inside dancing, and the dog is at the feet. And the tools that they were using to work are somewhere in the picture too. They were on break time. And what I'm saying is the Irish, Elliot and Brother Richard, if they had come to America and said, I'm Irish, I'm not white, that would have been the revolution we needed. We didn't need the black revolution. We needed the white revolution. Let me say that again, because you ain't going to hear this anywhere else, Elliot. Explain this way. We needed we needed one white group in America to say we ain't white. And that would have changed the whole thing, especially a group like the Irish. Why? Guess what, everybody? The number one group in America now in population among whites is not the Anglo, is not the WASP, is not the British, is not the It's not the Jews, it's the Irish. They overcame the British. So the main white you're dealing with is the one that called you nigger first, or at least when he was trying to deflect from his own status. So what I'm saying is, we had to deal with all kind of white folk. We had to deal with the Anglo that thought we were less than human. Then we had to deal with the less than human white folk who used their low position to get over their low position by trying to betray us. And the betrayal is when black folk went to Dublin, they tried to get Danny O'Connell to take a pro-black American abolitionist position, and he said yes, and he spoke into American politics. If you go back far enough, you'll see Danny O'Connell, their George Washington, was destroyed in history politically for taking a pro-black American position when Remond went and asked him. Nobody knows this stuff. But we sent folk to Ireland and said, tell the Irish to be on our side. Because they already said you ain't black. They already said the Irish ain't white. Ain't nobody thought the Irish were white. Nobody thought the Irish were white. They called them inside out niggers. They called them green niggers. They called them everything green that they called us black. But yeah, they did not call them white. They used us to become white. So when you see police hating on you, the root of that is the fact that this is a low white group trying to become the top white group at the expense of the non-white groups. And that's what the Jews and the Irish have done in America. They were victims of enslavement and Holocaust over in Europe, and all they had to do come to America and use the N-word, and all of a sudden they became white. And that's what happened. Ignatieff documents this in his book, How the Irish Became White. They became white by betraying us. And nobody talks about this because they were not considered white. They went out of their way to use us by lynching us. This is how they become white. They become white by killing us. They become white by becoming the police. They become white by becoming the marshals. They become white through us. The Irish were Irish. We made them white.
Dr. Taylor, we getting near the end of the program. We got about 2-3 minutes.
You got me burning up.
Listen, before we go, we just call him and hold it.
That's my last point. I just want to say about this. I just want to understand our problem with the police is deeper and related to the problem of original race betrayal. If the Irish had said we're white, we're Irish, not white, it wouldn't have changed nothing. Like Harvard is Irish, Boston is Irish, the Kennedys are Irish, Al E. Smith was Irish. They didn't have to give up being Notre Dame. They didn't have to give up Boston Celtics. They still proud to be Irish, but they wanted to become white. And I'm saying if they just stayed Irish, everybody would have said you ain't white. And therefore, that group could have messed the cart of race in such a way that the category of race would be useless if the Irish had just said we not white. Instead, they become the most white group to the day, that's the main white group we're beefing with in the form of policing, and most of us don't even understand where the animosity from police come from. It comes from the Irishness of the original entity called policing in America.
Let me grab this, we got 2 minutes left, and let me grab this call. 215.
Oh, good evening, Brother Elliot. How you doing, man?
All right, sir.
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Brother Richard? How you doing, Professor Taylor? How you doing, my brother?
I'm right, brother.
Praise be to Allah. You know, Professor Taylor, you mentioned 1909.
But we got 2 minutes. I'm sorry, Joe, but we right up against it. So, just kind of make it
I'll try to make it as quick as I can, Elliot.
Okay.
You know, like I said, in 1909, like I said, you mentioned 1909. It made me think about my paternal grandmother. She was born in November 1909, and she made transition in March of 1995. And, you know, Professor Tell, I want to thank you when you was on with Ellen Richard a while ago, a couple years ago. I try to tie this up real quick. You talked, I think you exposed the true Al Sharpton. I don't know if you remember that conversation. I appreciate that, too, because so many of us in Black America, so many of our people in Black America, Professor Ted, they don't know Al Sharpton, the slime ball that he is, and the disgraceful stuff that he does to our people, the two-faced, the duplicitous traitor that he is. I was so glad that you exposed him on Brother on Time from the Wake with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot a few years ago. And real quick, when you talk about the the egos and stuff with among our people and the political Democrat Republican back and forth. You know, it's an old definition by Einstein, quoted with saying you heard the term. You know, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over again, expect different results. Now you see here today is a prime example. You had Black folks down at Dr. King's Church, Ebenezer, had Biden speaking there. Now it's the same Joe Biden and the Democrat Party that can't get a damn John Lewis voting rights bill passed. They can't get a George Floyd bill passed to keep these cops accountable and all that stuff. But he can down there talk with some. He's supporting Dr. King and the Dream. See, this is the games they play on Black people, man. Yep. And we keep going for it, and we wonder why nothing changed. See, that kind of Black leadership, Dr. Taylor, has got to be exposed. The Hakeem Jeffries, the Sharptons of the world, because they keep our people in a stupor. You keep on, and so every Dr. King's birthday, whether it's Biden down there, whether it's Clinton, any one of them devils down there, saying the same old dumb stuff over and over again, and nothing changes because, like I said, you can't get a bill passed to support, like Malcolm said, you put them first, they put you last. And our people keep going for this okey-doke over and over again. So it got to be a change, Professor Taylor. I just want to say that because I know y'all short on time.
That's why this conversation is important. We have to try to figure out some other kind of strategies, and I think that's what this conversation is about, is looking at the past, what kind of models and examples can we find that can help us, you know, go forward. We have, our people are about to grow from 45 to 75 million as a population over the next 30 years. We have got to come up with some kind of organized Black political strategy, because we are a group that votes 95%. On a bad day, if we vote 88% together, everybody loses. So think about how powerful we are. But if we organize it in a way institutionally for our purposes, then we can fight both parties. But we got too many folk in them parties to be able to do that. And Cruz said we got to have a revolution against Blacks who are in the parties, with a more independent alternative in order to, you know, pull the people away from that dependency. So we got to have a fight with Black Democrats. Hip-hop was supposed to be the generation that Cruz thought was going to rise up against the Black Democrats. Mm-hmm. But hip-hop, all they did was got old and became Black Democrats.
Yeah, that is so true, Professor Taylor. And I thank you. I know y'all showed on time. Thanks, Professor Taylor. And good conversation, good information tonight. Brother Elliot, I'll put me on mute and I'll listen to the remainder few minutes of the show.
Thank you, sir.
Put me on mute, too.
Listen, Dr. Taylor, thanks for being with us. Hey, listen, before we go, tell the folks how to get the the book Black Nationalism in the United States.
I don't care about the book right now because I'm working on another one, but I want them to read that article called the Politics of the Black Power Movement, because that won't cost them any money. Good. And you can go online and download it. And it's more recent arguing, and it's getting into a lot of, it synthesizes my other arguments about black power, about where we are. So if you read that article, you'll get exactly what I talk about, the cultural front, the economic front, the political front. I talk about that in that article. Get that article, James Lance Taylor, The Politics of the Black Power Movement. It's online. You should be able to Google it and get it right away. Thank you, brothers. I appreciate it. Sorry to go on and on, but I'm like Jeremiah. I feel like I got fire shut up in my bones, man. I got to let it out.
We'll talk soon.
I want my people to be free.
We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you, all everybody.
Right. Richard.
Yes, yes.
Oh, no, I'll tell you something. The class is over. It's a lot of things that he touched on, and you know, we're gonna be reviewing these things in future programs because they don't always be coming up. In fact, I had some things I wanted to share, but I'll do that the next program. And we got some good programs coming up in the pipeline, so we'll kind of be billboarding some things within the next couple of weeks. Before we leave this evening, I just want to give out the lineup for Time for an Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting topics and dialogue on African perspectives. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Tuesday, the return of the Black Reality Think Tank, which will be in February, with host Brother Alfonso Watkins taking the reins from Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, Brother Patrick Lumumba, Mississippi on the Move, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. That's from 7 to 8, I'm sorry, on Thursdays. And I'm sorry, let me go back. The Black Reality Think Tank will be in the same time that Dr. Rogers' program was on Tuesdays. That's 8 to 10 p.m. on Time for an Awakening Media. On Saturdays, the Elders of Sankofa with Dr. Janine James from 7 to 9 on Saturday evenings. And then on Sundays, Time for Awakening is back from 7 until, also Time for Awakening is from 8 on Friday, from 8 until, and we'll be starting that up probably this Friday again, because we've been on a little hiatus there with the Friday program, but we'll be starting on Fridays, 8 until Time for an Awakening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Fireman.
children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.